still counting. It's our number one song. That's it for us. I'm Nikki Sixx. I'm here with Carrie Kasem. If you missed any part of our chart, get caught up at thesideshowcountdown.com.
And if you want to listen to us, no matter where you are, download the iHeartRadio app for free.
We'll see you next weekend.
The Sideshow is now over. Go ahead. Stick a golden fork in it. We're done.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby. Yeah, it's me, Peter Werby. Welcome to the broadcast. It's Night Call with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan. Jalene, off tonight. She is under the weather. Actually, she's feeling pretty good, but she has a bad case of laryngitis. In fact, if you go to our Facebook page for Night Call on WRIF, here's what she wrote. Here's your right-wing sexist dream come true. I have laryngitis and won't be on the show tonight. But Jalene says, I'll be your worst nightmare when I'm back next week. That from Jalene. Hey, our phone numbers are 313-298-WRIF, and usually Jalene gives you the numbers. You know, after all these years, you'd think I'd remember that. I got to read them. 313-298-9743. Well, did you ever want a job in radio? Here's your chance to be my co-star, my co-host, because usually Jalene sits across from me, and we talk about what's going on in the world. We comment on your calls, but she's not here tonight, and so it's up to you and me, and also Athena, who is answering the phones at 313-298-WRIF. If you want to see Jalene's remarks, you can go to facebook.com/nightcall. And so she's, you know, she's lost her voice, but not her spunk, huh? So please do join us. We're going to be open line. I'm going to make a few remarks, and it's up to you. This has been the longest week, I think, of my life. Well, you know, when you're a kid, you know, you're like a in school, or you know how long a day is when you're sitting there in school watching the clock and got some mean teacher and something like that. Pardon me, but as an adult, this was the absolute longest. I don't know, maybe because the 4th of July was in the middle. And then, I don't know whether you folks experienced this, but at our house, and I know at Jalene's house as well, we lost power. So here we are, 97 degrees, 101 degrees. And no, nothing, right? Nothing's working at all. No phones, no, certainly no air conditioning. And, you know, our standards have changed because, I mean, ask your grandparents or your parents. And you know, back in the day, they didn't have any of that. It was just hot, and it was really miserable. A lot of times the best that people had were small fans. But now we have actually come to expect air conditioning. And, you know, the conditioning, let me put it a different way. There's a cultural expectation now to have everything within a certain range of comfort. And that's not just here. It's also true all around the world in extremely hot climates, like, for instance, in Baghdad, in Mumbai, which used to be, you know, Bombay in India. In Mumbai, half of the electrical use of the whole country now is for air conditioning. And you go, yeah, so wouldn't you rather be cool than not? Well, you know what? If you got to work outside, you're screwed regardless of how many modern conveniences you have. You just got to do it. But the other thing is that, I don't know, just being, I mean, you come out of a confined space, right? At birth, that's where you're conceived, and that's, you know, where you grow. And, you know, once you exit the womb, then you're out in the open. And then most of the time you're kept in confined spaces. All winter we're kept in confined spaces. At the end of it all, we wind up in another box, right? Well, I would like to spend as much time with the breeze blowing through my hair as possible. And the demand for people, I won't even say her name, and it's not Jalene, but someone very near and dear to me, very close to me. In fact, someone I love and live with, you know, these people that wants it real cool. I don't know how it is in your house. I mean, a lot of people always tell me about the arguments about the air conditioning. And every time my wife and I walk by the air conditioning, I mean, you know, I put it down a couple notches. She puts it up a couple notches. And then I go, I can't stand this. I got to have the windows open, you know, where I work at home. And also, if you're doing outside work, it's like 97 outside and it's like 71 inside. You know, it's like walking into a refrigerator. But it was all out, and my wife and I, we slept downstairs on couches. But, you know, a few of the neighbors, they wanted to make sure that they were prepared, and they started their generators. So for those of us who didn't have generators, it was like sleeping in a truck stop parking lot, right? Because all you could hear those damn generators going. So that's what's been happening around here. I know a lot of you lost power as well. Now, geez, just woke up this morning, cool as could be. We got our our electricity back. You know, there are, well, I don't know how many of you live in a neighborhood where you wake up on the around the 4th of July and you find little flags on your lawn. And they used to be made in China. In fact, they just made a law in Michigan saying that flags that are displayed have to be made in the United States. Whatever. But mostly they're not done out of patriotism. Or what's the intermingling of patriotism and commercial concerns? Because, and I won't say the realtor's name, but every flag that, and this wasn't in my neighborhood, this was, a lot of these were in Pleasant Ridge, which are sort of, you know, upper middle class neighborhood, nice people. A lot of my friends live there. And yet, when you looked at the bottom of the flag, it said compliments of, and it named this realtor and the realty firm. And it says proudly wave your flag on these days, and then it names everything under the sun from New Year's Day to Election Day and Flag Day. Well, Flag Day, that makes some sense. Armed Forces Day, Memorial Day, whatever. So, I mean, of course, these people are selling flags, and they want you to buy them. But, so this is just, is it an intermingling, or is it just pure commercial interest under the guise of patriotism, the celebration of the foundation of our nation? It always occurred to me that if I ever found one on my lawn, I was going to take the realtor. In fact, first what I was going to do, I was going to bill the realtor for advertising space on my lawn, right? Saying, well, you know, because it's not like putting it in, you know, sending me in the mail or even dropping it in a little, what do you call those, a little container box outside of my door for magazines and what have you. This is setting it up on my property without my permission. You know, who the hell gave you the right to put anything on my lawn? You know, property rights, all that crap. But, they never put one on there. But I was going to say, bill them, and they would, of course, laugh and probably not even respond. But I was going to take them to some, you know, this is these, you know, what I'm, you'd think, don't I have enough other real things to think about? Take this realtor to court saying, hey, I want to sue you for doing this, but whatever. Any thoughts on that? 313-298-WRIF. You can be a radio co-star calling me up. And it was hot as hell, let me tell you. At 11 o'clock, no, what must it have been? Friday night, Thursday night, I can't. They all just sort of blended together, just, you know, without electricity. It was actually kind of neat not having a computer in front of me where I spend good parts of my waking hours, unfortunately. But remember, it was 11 o'clock at night. I was down our street, sitting in the backyard with a bunch of neighbors, putting back some cold ones. And I was just dripping with sweat. It was still like probably 93 at 11 o'clock or something like that. And as I said earlier, that's what we used to do. But now, you know, it's like we've been condemned to hell, literally, you know. Well, not literally, I guess, but in terms of the heat. And, you know, the big argument that these righties, and I want to talk about why I put that little designation in there, the righties still claiming there's no global warming. And, you know, there's other hot summers, but most of the hot summers in our lifetime, in fact, they're increasingly warm, have been because of human-caused climate change. And if you look at the Associated Press, it says, if you want a glimpse of some of the worst of global warming, scientists suggest taking a look at the U.S. weather in recent weeks. Notice that. It's scientists. It's not talk show hosts. It's not, politicians on the right or anything like that. Scientists. Horrendous wildfires. You've been noticing all this, right? Oppressive heat waves, devastating droughts, flooding from giant deluges, and a powerful freak windstorm that they now call a derecho. Derecho means right. And I guess it also means, any Spanish speakers there, they're saying it means straight ahead. It's sort of these wind shears that go knocking everything down its path. Not a tornado, not circular. These are the kind of extremes climate scientists have predicted will come with climate change, although it's far too early to say that is the cause. You know, I mean, so they're always temporizing here. I mean, all the climatologists say this is the case. Some of these other scientists, particularly in the ones that are in the pay of these big energy companies, they say it's not. Everyone who you can really take seriously says it is. Nor will they say global warming is the reason. Yes, what are they talking about? Climate scientists do say this. Man, what a load of crap. Why do I have this on my website? I'm taking it off. There's 4,000 daily high temperature records were set in the month of June, and something like 24,000 have been broken since the beginning of the year. So, and a lot of stuff happening in Asia and Africa. Russia just had this huge storm that killed like 150 people. And what is really frightening is this could be the good old days, right? We can say, hey, I remember when it was only 101. You know, boy, I wish it was that cool tonight. But these warnings from climate scientists have been coming since 1988, and they said that climate change is going to bring increased heat waves, more droughts, sudden downpours, and widespread wildfires and worsening storms, and all these extremes are happening now. So why do I keep mentioning the right wing? Why do these righties figure in this? Well, that's a question you should ask them, because in most things, and I don't want to give up my critical thinking to any group of experts, but you're kind of stuck on, in some regards, depending on what people that don't have a dog in the fight say and the conclusions they come to. What I mean by that is, great numbers of the people that deny that there's climate change or deny that it's human-caused climate change have a dog in the fight because they're being financed by these huge energy conglomerates, particularly people like the Koch brothers, K-O-C-H. So if you're going to trust somebody, why wouldn't you trust the people who only have the concerns of science and of the world at stake and aren't being bought and sold like our democracy is by the same people? And why in the world would the average person, because wait a minute, well here, let me just grab another story. This is seemingly like a completely different thing. Tax-exempt groups shield political gifts of businesses. Is that all clear in there? Tax-exempt groups shield political gifts of businesses. So as you probably know by now, this election is up for sale and the billionaires are putting all their big money on Mitt Romney. And here, well, let me just read you the first sentence of this New York Times article from July 7th. American Electric Power. What? No, how many of you ever heard of that? I never did. One of the country's largest utilities gave $1 million last November to the Founding Fund, a new tax-exempt group that intends to raise most of its money from corporations and push for limited government. I've heard that phrase a lot, right? Limited government. Ooh, that doesn't sound like a bad idea, because governments in the main have been tyrannical throughout history. I mean, if we want to include like the United States and Britain, Sweden, Canada, places like that among the democratic nations among the nations that have been democratic since the nation state arose about 4,000 years ago, you know, us and them probably, I don't know what, 2%. Mostly government is a racket to protect the wealth and power of the ruling class, of the rulers, the people that make the decision and do not like people below them trying to intervene in the process of rule. Because generally what we say is, can we have a little say in this since this affects us? Or is there any way we could get you to stop hogging all of the money? Yeah, and stop forcing us into being your slaves or your wage slaves or your peasants or whatever. So they don't like that. So then they hire a bunch of men with swords or guns, and when we get out of hand, then they try to. Well, I mean, they got a lot of tricks before they get to that level. But that's like a whole different story. But let's get back to this. So limited government, boy, that sounds so good, doesn't it? You'd think like a raving anarchist like me would think, limited. Yeah, that's a little too much. Don't we want to go for the no government thing? Don't we want to go back to the Senecas and the Cherokees and the Potawatomis and people like that kind of ruled by consensus and all that? But let's look at that phrase. I mean, this is another one of the phrases that the right wing has successfully thrown into political dialogue that doesn't really mean what it says. Like right to work, right? You know, that really means the right to destroy unions. The right to life, that means men will vote to stop women from having abortions, right? Trying to think of some other one. Oh, special interests. Yeah, that it's not them. It's not all the billionaires that fund them. It's the labor unions or it's civil rights groups. That's where they invented that one. And one time I had a whole list of them, and I can't think of the rest of them. Maybe you can. In fact, you can phone me up and be my co-host with Jalene out for the evening at 313-298-WRIF. If you're more inclined to email, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Okay, so what does limited government mean? And what does limited government mean to you? And what does limited government mean to American Electric Power, one of the country's largest utilities? It gives $1 million to the founding fund that is gets most of its money from corporation and pushes for limited government. Well, it's pretty clear, isn't it? They don't want any regulations on them poisoning the world with their pollution. Oh, they'll give you all, you know, you got the right now to have firecrackers and carry guns on your, you know, on your waist and, not wear a helmet. They go, well, you know, that's limited government. You know, we don't want a government telling us what to do. That's a whole separate thing. But what they're all about and the reason that these corporations are going to fund Mitt Romney is not because he's a job creator, because anybody with any sense knows he's not a job creator anywhere that he actually, you can document what he did. He was a job destroyer through, this Bain fund. So, in fact, they don't even care whether there's more jobs or not. They don't care whether Obama or Romney or whoever is a job killer or a job creator. Because if you notice, even with still high unemployment and what they call bad jobs report, they're doing great. Them, the 1%, the rulers, the people that make democracy a sham. And one of the ways they make it a sham is by being able to contribute this enormous amount of money. I'm wondering whether, there's got to be some, we've been inviting people, conservatives that say, no, this is these Republicans and these huge corporations that fund the Republican Party with billions of dollars. We'll get to the Democratic Party in a second. That fund the Republican Party with billions of dollars so they'll have limited government, which means limited regulation on their banking and financial interests and activities. Remember, that's what Romney says, that, they want to, and he wants to cut taxes on the job creators. I guess that's American Electric Power, and that's all these financial firms and hedge funds and what have you. But also the giant insurer Aetna directed more than $3 million last year to American Action Network, a Republican nonprofit organization that has spent millions of dollars attacking lawmakers who voted for President Obama's health care bill. It's crazy. Aetna's president publicly voiced support for the legislation. So I don't even get that. Why would they want that? Why would they spend their stockholders' money to defeat this essentially Republican healthcare bill? Remember, it was the Republicans, a right-wing think tank. I know that's kind of an oxymoron, but the Heritage Fund that suggested what Mitt Romney put into action in the state as Romney Care, of which everyone loves. Everything that's great there. It's a bureaucracy. Private healthcare plans, government healthcare plans, everybody's going to have a bitch about it, right? I do. I got great healthcare insurance. But do you want me to sit and spend, the next 10 or 15 minutes and tell you every time I had to stay on hold for 20 minutes and try to go through this labyrinth of their bureaucracy to get something paid and why didn't they do that? And it does too fit the definition. This is private. This is, their dream. They don't want anything to do with government, unless they're getting, the government to give them lower taxes and what have you. Let's see, other corporations, including Prudential Financial, Dow Chemical, and the drug maker Merck. And Merck just had some bad thing going, didn't they? have poured millions of dollars more into the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, a tax-exempt, that's another thing, tax-exempt trade group that has pledged to spend at least $50 million on political advertising this election cycle, all against Democrats. Now, is there one of you, I mean, is there one of you suckers, you know, and this is not like calling you an a-hole or something, but suckers in terms of, you know, being fooled, that believe that the Republicans actually have your interest at heart when they act out the script of these huge corporations that care only to make more profit. You know, like I said, oh yeah, let them blow their fingers off of their firecrackers or become organ donors so they can ride without helmets and you know, stuff like that, you know. But, I mean, the idea that you would think that they act in your interest. I mean, I think if you really pushed a lot of you, you would say, no, come on, they're all, you get to it, they're all the same. But you know what? It's, and no one will admit this, of course. I mean, the perception of the Democratic Party is that it's a party of minorities, of women, of labor who you resent because they're making good wages. At least they were, not anymore. And so, you know, they're, both parties are elites. So at least I'll be able to vote against these people I resent. Now, there's someone here at work that said, a very cynical person in their 20s, who said, here's my choice between voting for a bunch of rich elites that don't care anything about me or voting for a bunch of rich elites who are going to provide medical care for me. He doesn't have any. He's going to get it in 2014 under Obamacare. And I said, well, that's kind of a slam dunk, isn't it? I mean, we shouldn't have rich elites that dominate the political system and the economy. I mean, they do most everywhere. I mean, it's a little hard to get out from under it. But I don't know. You tell me. 313-298-WRIF. And let me actually, boy, maneuvering all this without Jalene is a task. I wanted to just, can't find it. What I'm looking for is I want to go back to I want to go back to our Facebook page, facebook.com/nightcall, and see if anybody is responding to Jalene's message about why she's not on the air. A couple other things, and actually I'd like to hear. People always say, you never give the other side of it. I wonder if these people call, like, these right-wing shows, which are about 90% of what's on radio, tell them the same thing. I tend to doubt it. But let me actually, a little later, I'm actually going to have a compliment for a Republican, if you can imagine that. But, you know, there's political criticisms. Let me see. I don't even know if I want to call it that. But there's criticism of Obamacare, of I'm even forgetting the, I don't have it in front of me, I can't remember, what is Affordable Care Act? Yeah, the Affordable Care Act. What a concept, huh? So we can actually have people that can afford health care. But Chief Justice John Roberts, who was the deciding vote in saying, yes, it's constitutional, and that there can be an individual mandate, like driving, we're required to have insurance. So here is what David Brooks in the New York Times on July 2nd objects to the Affordable Health Care Act or Obamacare, which is fine. I mean, there was Romney Care in Massachusetts. One thing that the guy ever did for ordinary people, and, you know, he says it's horrible because, well, you know, he says it's okay for the state, but it shouldn't be all right for the country. Why? Well, it's not real clear, you know, because, I mean, you could, what about the states that can't afford it? And that's increasingly states that can't afford it. What about these states run by right wingers that don't want it and won't let people have it? Michigan could even be one. I'll talk about that a little later. But here's what David Brooks says. It's very long, so I'm only going to look at a kind of, he says the law creates complex structures that inevitably produce unintended consequences. In other words, he goes on a long thing about, this is going to create another level of bureaucracy in our life. Well, if you have private insurance, it's not going to create another level of bureaucracy. It's going to have the same level of private bureaucracy that you've had all along. If you don't have insurance, you might have to have another, you don't have health insurance, so you don't have any. So this will be, you know, that will happen. Now, this is very interesting. This could be true, but listen to the language that David Brooks uses. A report by the House Ways and Means Committee, he doesn't say that it's dominated by the Republicans, found that 71% of the Fortune 100 companies have an incentive to drop coverage. But nobody really knows what's going to happen. I mean, doesn't this guy have an editor? That is a statement of saying absolutely nothing. He says they found that they have an incentive. What the incentive is, if they blew off their health insurance, say, you know, we're cutting all health insurance, they could go on government, the Obamacare. But really, nobody knows what's going to happen. So maybe you shouldn't say that, because if you don't know what's going to happen, why are you even picking up print? Why are you killing trees? A Congressional Budget Office study this year estimated that 20 million could lose coverage under the law, or perhaps 3 million could gain employer coverage, or the number could be inside or outside the range. So, you know, in other words, he's saying nobody knows what's going to happen. In fact, he says there are other possible perverse effects. All of this could be true. I mean, it's possible that this will not work out well. But one of the things, if 70% of the Fortune 100 companies drop coverage, well, isn't that an incentive to have what we should have? Universal, single-payer health care like every other damn nation in the... damn nation, that's kind of cool. Darn nation in the world, like our pals in Canada, yeah? Or all of our allies and all that, yeah? And then he talks about that it could drive doctors out of Medicare. That'd be terrible. Another report from the department suggests there could be 84 million Americans on Medicaid, an astounding burden on that already stretched system. That's very true, and that is a big problem, dear radio friends. Indeed. What does this tell you, though? I mean, what he's saying. I mean, you got always, you know, when conservatives talk, it's always in front of your face, but always behind your back. Remember that. I mean, they've always got their one-eyed jacks. They've got always got one side of their face that they're not showing. Because, you know, as I said, they're always acting out of this, you know, the big guys. Maybe some of you, you know, have this philosophical thing. We should have firecrackers and carry guns on our waist and all that. I mean, that's just personal libertarian philosophy. And that's, you know, that's not what's going on. This is about big policy decisions. This is about billions and billions of dollars. This is about millions and millions of people's well-being. So why do we have, Medicaid is for the poor, right? So why do we have the richest country in the world that has 84 million people on Medicaid? That is for people, you know, that can't afford Medicare. I mean, it has to do with the distribution of income. It has to do with, you know, one person ahead of a company making $378 million a year. And all of the police and firefighters in Scranton, Pennsylvania, making $7.25 an hour. That's right. They just all got cut back to the minimum wage. So... The head, Timothy Cook, the head of Apple. I mean, he could say, whoa, I just heard that the Scranton first responders can't even afford to pay their bills anymore because they're now knocked down to the minimum wage. I'm going to send them a check for $8 million. Everyone, oh, no. And then I'll only have $370 million for the year. I can't do that. You get that, right? Let me see what else. He says the law, doesn't fix the underlying structures that make the American health system so inefficient. That's true, thanks to the Republican, unwillingness to do so. I mean, what really we need is Medicare for everybody. And you can do that by taking out the two words over 65 in the Medicare bill. So let me see. This does go on and on. And then David Brooks, who is, the moderate Republicans, he says there, in fact, is a proposal, a policy proposal put forth by the Republicans that will, in fact, dear listeners, give you health care. Or, you know, because a lot of you have health care and you know it's not worth a damn. Doesn't pay for much, right? Unless you have some catastrophic injury and or illness. And then it's got a cap on it, which, by the way, is going to be illegal by 2014 under Obamacare. So there's this long, long summary of the Republican plan. So it's, I can't even begin to do it. But you know, Americans should be strongly encouraged to buy continuous coverage over their adulthood. Then insurance companies would not be permitted to jack up their premiums if a member of their family develops costly conditions. Good. The Republican approach would encourage experimentation in the states instead of restricting state flexibility. Well, you can see where that's going. Instead of locking Medicaid recipients into substandard system, what's the answer there? Make it above standard. The Republicans would welcome them into the same private insurance health markets as their fellow citizen. They would get, and wait a minute. I'm trying to look for some of these. This approach would replace Medicare's open-ended cost burden with a defined contribution structure. Beneficiaries would choose from a menu of approved plans. If they wanted a more expensive plan, they could pay for it on top of the fixed premium. Well, gee, I'm sure glad he's getting away from bureaucracies, you know, so that we have this freedom. Why should we have to face any of that? Why don't we just have like Canada does? You're sick, you go in, and they take care of you. Doesn't that seem to be the deal? Well, gee, you know what? When Jolene's here, we laugh and laugh and laugh, don't we? And when I'm here, it's grumble, 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 grumble. Well, there, I laugh. You can be my co-star. You can be my co-host. And let me see. Is this, do we got this in here? Yeah, we got this in here to tell you where to call. Michael's in Fenton, Jake's in Macomb. That means there's four more open lines to be my co-host.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julian Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julian will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Get swimsuit ready and reveal your true shape. Discover Cellulize. Hi, I'm Dr. Michael Gray. A new technique that breaks up cellulite and fat directly underneath the top layers of the skin. Once cellulite fibers are destroyed, the skin looks smoother. Cellulite is no longer a reason to stay out of the swimsuit this summer. Summer 2012, reveal your true self cellulite free. It's possible. It's Cellulize.
Call 248-538-3333 or anewyou.com.
Call me today, and I'll see you tomorrow. Nationwide, most women prefer scarless breast augmentation. I am Dr. Michael Gray, and I've been performing this scarless procedure for over 20 years now. It is still the number one choice among women choosing breast augmentation. Visit anewyou.com to see before and after photos of my scarless procedure. Schedule your complimentary consultation to learn why scarless breast augmentation could be right for you.
Call 248-538-3333.
I am Dr. Michael Gray. Call me today, and I will see you tomorrow.
Good news, guys. Hey, it's Susie Cole from The Riff, giving you the heads up that WRIF.com and Pepsi are keeping your finger on the pulse of the music world. I'm talking about my Riff Rock Report, online at WRIF.com. Check it out to find out what's happening in the world of rock, including my blog to get the scoop on new music, local bands, shows, and events happening in and around Metro Detroit.
It's Susie Cole's Riff Rock Report.
Powered by Pepsi. Live for now.
Check it out today at WRIF.com.
There's so many songs about finding love, yet so few about finding a great price on car insurance. Why? Well, isn't shopping for car insurance a never-ending drama filled with struggle, tears, and heartbreak? As it turns out with Esurance, not so much. See, Esurance was built to cost less, which is kind of music to your ears. Or at least your wallet. Visit Esurance.com or call 1-800-ESURANCE for a quote.
Not available in all states. Savings may vary.
Detroit's rock station rocks worldwide. You're listening to WRIF.com.
Watch. back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
Thank you very much, and welcome back. Jolene is off for the evening. If you want to see why, go to our Facebook page at facebook.com/nightcall. It's pretty funny. Already getting a few likes, and you can comment on it. I want to keep talking about the healthcare plan. How's it going to affect you? I mean, that then we don't even know. I mean, it might turn out to suck. It might really set the stage for the kind of health plan that we need. That is one that we get as a matter of citizenship. A little later, too, after I take a couple of your calls, I want to talk about this column I saw in today's New York Times, Why Conservatives Are Happier Than Liberals. Huh? All right, I'm going to take the first call, and some of you who are regular listeners may remember that that we were having a problem. I didn't realize that because I'm looking at these meters, you see how loud it is, and I'm listening in my headphones, and you sound loud enough, then people are writing, so I can hardly hear the callers. So I'm going to try to be, one of our great engineers, Sherry Powers, said, here's what you got to do. So I'm going to try something different. And so I'd like you to tell me for sure if there's any problem. By the way, I don't know if you were listening to the commercials, but one of them was talking about this film, Moonrise Kingdom. Absolutely over the top. Check it out. It's if you're in the Detroit area, it's at the main art theater. All right, let's get some of these first people who have been waiting the longest. Here's Michael in Fenton. Michael, hey, it's Peter. You're on the air. Welcome. Let me stamp. I didn't do it. Hold on. There we go. Hey, go ahead, Michael. You're on the air now.
I'd like to say we love you, Julian. Get well fast.
Okay.
Yeah, a couple comments, and I'd like to talk about that limited government. After I get off the phone call, I would like for you to tell us more about the Koch brothers. I don't know much about them.
Okay, well, let me just interrupt you 1 second. What I was talking about before was that all of these corporations are giving money to the Republicans to push for limited government. And this is one of the things Michael is responding to this. Limited government, which means to you and I, maybe something different. I was being facetious, and it means it's that we got, we can blow off firecrackers and ride without a helmet and wear guns strapped to our waist. But what the big money is really all about is that they mean that they don't have regulations on their financial transactions, or their pollution. And that's why they spend so much money. It's an investment. They're going to spend tens of millions of dollars in order to make hundreds of millions of dollars through their crooked financial investments or, through killing us through the pollution. But go ahead, Michael. Sorry.
Yeah, I'd like to congratulate Thaddeus McCotter for getting caught and then for cheating again for the Republicans. But
he also just resigned. This is Representative Thaddeus McCotter, who had the worst, phoniest, most fraudulent nomination petitions imaginable. Good, he's out of there.
Yeah, I talked to a lady in California the other day that looked into that kind of stuff, and I guess they're going to go after him and try to prosecute him, but they. The Romney care is really, it's Romney Roberts care, and that goes into what I was wanting to talk about with limited government. Limited government would be like Romney becoming president and teaming up with Justice Roberts, and what we would have is a dictatorship, and then they could proceed, because this president thing, it doesn't seem to be working anymore, so it looks like they got some kind of plan with, we're going to end up like with the dictator or something.
Well, but I don't think so, Michael. Why would they want a dictatorship? The way things are going, it runs just fine. It's like an old Bob Dylan song, money doesn't talk, it swears. And with the Roberts Court allowing the Citizens United, which says that the government cannot limit the amount of financial contributions that anyone or any entity being the corporations can spend, it's all about how much money there is. But I wonder. They're talking about they're going to use $1 billion for advertising. We'll go out of our minds. All right, Michael, thank you very much. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Here's Jake in Macomb. Jake, hey, it's Peter without Jolene. Hi, you're on the air.
That anyone or any entity
You know, I need you to
can spend.
All right, here's what we're going to do. We're going to, you'll still be listening to your radio. We're going to put you on hold, and then you have to turn your radio completely off and listen to the show on the air. Or I'm sorry, on the phone. That's it. Not on the air, on the phone. Here's Mike in Jackson. Mike, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Peter, I just finished the book, The Amateur, and it's based on the premise that Barack Obama entered the presidency with no executive experience, no management experience, that he's a lightweight.
Yeah.
And everything like that. And I think we're giving him for 4 more years. I was wondering, where do you think he is on the learning curve? And,
Romney has run a business. I mean, he was the governor. He was the governor of Massachusetts. I mean, I don't think that any problem that has come about because of, that any problem that Obama is experiencing is because of lack of administrative experience. I mean, this is just, it's a politicized book. It's put out by, a right-wing author and a right-wing publisher. What are they going to say? Oh, he's great. Does great as an administrator. Are you with me?
Yes, I sure am, Peter.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you, if you read that and you go, oh my God, this guy's total loser. He can't, he couldn't pour crap out of a boot if the instructions were on the heel. You know, that's the Lyndon Johnson phrase. But I don't know. I mean, my problem with him, and there are a lot of political problems I do have with Barack Obama, is what he either has done or hasn't done. So it's nothing to do with his administrative skills. And so let's say that Romney has some administrative skills with the experience as a governor from running this business. He's pretty crafty as a businessman, no doubt about that. I mean, look at all the money he's made. And, if that's an indication, but I don't know if it doesn't exactly strike me as the kind of man I want as a president. Okay. The spaces are too big. Thank you. That is a book that is very popular on the New York Times bestseller list. All right. Let's do this. I was going to talk about why conservatives are happier than liberals, according to Arthur C. Brooks. But since Jeff is calling from Virginia, let's get him on the air. Jeff, welcome to the show. You're on the air.
How you doing, Peter? Been a long time listener. I started listening in the 1980s, and you actually kind of turned me more liberal, but I sit on the fence mostly.
Okay.
I'm actually from Windsor, Ontario. I live in Virginia right now. I'm moving to D.C. Tomorrow, actually. I'm moving in three blocks away from the White House. I work at a hospital very close to the White House in the emergency department. But my main interest was the Obamacare thing. One of the basic things I've read about the Obamacare is like a really good thing. It's like stuff not denying how not putting a cap on somebody's insurance, not denying them insurance, stuff like that. That's really good stuff. I mean, like I run into a lot of people that are Republican, like all our insurance is going are. Our healthcare system is going to the way of Canada, and they always ask me about the Canadian healthcare system, and they're always like trying to pick up something negative about it. I think it's a good way; it's going towards the right direction, but there's not going to be overnight fix of the problem. There's a major problem with like people making money off healthcare. Like every dollar that's spent on healthcare in the United States, it's like don't quote me on this. It's like 50-60% of it, it's like going to administrative costs. Like I know in other countries, like maybe Canada, 5% of that does. Now, if you can cut that out, you can get everybody insured with the best health care in the world.
Sure. And talk about an expansion of people into jobs. I mean, I always use the – did you say you're a doctor?
No, I'm a registered nurse. I work in the emergency department.
One more time. Say it for me again.
You're right. Registered nurse.
Oh, registered nurse. Okay. Yeah. And, this is, this always grosses Jalene, my co-host out, who's not here tonight. But like I say, I have, an ear, nose, and throat guy that cleans my ears. And you could do that, right?
I've done it.
Sure. I mean, that's one of the things that, And that could be done for, I mean, I'm sure that somebody could probably, if I was in and out of there in 5 minutes, could probably spend, be $25 or $30 at the most. This guy is billing my company or my health insurance company for like $175.
Well, I had a recent experience. One of the hospitals I worked with in D.C., basically I went in there. I was, like, so dehydrated. I had the flu. Like, I went to work, and they told me you need to be seen. I paid my $100 copayment, and I got 8 liters of IV fluid dumped into me. Almost got admitted, and then the insurance company sent me the bill, so they're only paying for half the bill.
Huh.
I'm like, I can't believe it. Like, I'm getting stuck with $500. I'm like, I have insurance. I paid for it. The doctor said that I need that. I'm fortunate for them when I talk to them and I'm not going to be like, ignorant. But they're going to lose, I hope.
Well, yeah, me too. And that kind of gives credence to what I was saying. It's not like, people say, I don't want to have to deal with a government bureaucracy. Well, dealing with a private bureaucracy is pretty bad as well. Well, hey, I'm glad you reconnected. Thank you, Jeff. I appreciate it. Thank you very much. And, I don't know why we don't do just a Canadian system, get rid of all of this. And, by the way, the Republicans are still trying to sink this, that failure to okay this health plan could cost the state. The Republicans are trying to torpedo it, which is kind of like a World War II thing. Do they use torpedoes still? Maybe. But the Republicans are putting up this roadblock so that Michigan could lose nearly $10 million in federal funding to set up a health insurance exchange because the legislature has to authorize the program this summer. And I was looking for what happened. This is going to be about subsidizing people that can't afford it. So, we should wind up in a situation where it's a benefit to almost everybody. If it doesn't work, it's got to be politically attacked. But the idea that you got these, what I was calling last week on the right, this fascist hysteria that, this one Republican was calling for armed rebellion. Yeah, we're giving everybody health care. Let's get our guns and meet in the town square. Bring the pitchforks and torches. I mean, they're just over the edge. They're just totally over the edge. The only time I've ever seen any suggestion of an alternative by the Republicans, it was one I was reading earlier, and that seemed a worse bureaucracy than anything. And the idea, of course, that Romney Care, which was the model for Obamacare, if you want to keep private insurance, that seems to be the way to go, but with a public option. Remember, that's what the Republicans and even some of the Democrats opposed, which was that the government itself would be an insurance agent to act as competition against these huge healthcare giants, which, one of the things that the Republicans have given up on is they wanted to make, or although maybe they haven't, I don't know, but they wanted to have what is available. One of the options I have through my health insurance is what's called health savings accounts. So my employer and me, WRIF and me, we contribute to this. We have to get up to this certain amount in a year, like about $2,000. You go, whoa, $2,000. But, well, that's, if you have just, if you're just paying for it, you got to, I don't know, it is so complicated. I mean, that's what I mean. If it's this complicated, it sucks. But in any event, what happens, though, because so I'm contributing to this health savings account, and it's my account, right? And I can use it for healthcare. And once I get up to this $2,000 threshold, if I did, then everything beyond that would be free. Wow, man, that's pretty good, huh? Except what's going on is the insurer has all this money of millions and millions of people in these health savings account, and they do what? They invested, right? So they're making a profit on the money that I'm depositing. It's this huge scam. It's this huge racket. And all this noise about, taking away our liberties, taking away our freedoms. Again, is there, how many of these righties, these teabaggers, that are over 65 would say, I want to get rid of my Medicare. Take away my Medicare because it's inconsistent with my political philosophy. Of course they don't. Remember that stupid sign that some of those nutballs had? Keep your government hands off my Medicare. Huh. So I'm saying let's just have Medicare for all. And does Medicare have problems? Yeah. Is it a bureaucracy? Yeah. But is everyone else's insurance private insurance? You know, yeah. And what about all the people? So that's socialized medicine, by the way. The cost is socialized, picked up by the government. And we got it. I mean, it's just the reason there's so many poor people, the reason that the first responders in Scranton, Pennsylvania are now working for the minimum wage is because the rich man has hogged all the money. I mean, he's decided, listen, I don't just want to go for a little bit. I'm going to take every little bit I can. And if it means first responders in Scranton going broke because I'm taking too much, I don't care. Because I want to be at the top of the New York Times list of CEOs that makes more money than anyone ever has in the history of the effing world. And because then, you know what I'm going to buy? I'm going to buy a pair of designer jeans. Well, no, I mean, that's not what they do. Here's an article. And let's see, Dave and Dylan, hang on. I'm going to get you guys off after the break. There's an article. I mean, it didn't even occur to me really to look too much in it. But it says on June 11th, the United States government filed a complaint documenting. Well, let me tell you the headline. Keep the dictators out of Malibu. You know, Malibu is this real cool surfer hangout in around Los Angeles. But the government filed a complaint documenting a record of corruption. The complaint detailed allegations of massive bribery and money laundering practiced by the son and heir apparent of Equatorial Guyana's dictator, Teodoro Obiang. This is his son. As his nation's minister of forestry, the younger Mr. Obiang, known as Teodorin, accumulated a fortune by forcing foreign timber companies to pay him lavish bribes, often in cash-filled suitcases. So this is, you know, you're thinking, yeah, right, third world, corrupt dictators and all that. While Washington has gotten better at shutting down terrorist financing and starving regimes like Sudan and Iran of investment, has done little to stop sitting dictators and their families from using America to stash their assets. Mr. Obiang's father seized power in 1979. I mean, we are so ignorant of Africa. I have no idea even where Equatorial Guyana gives me sort of an idea of what it's close to, right? But anyway, Mr. Obiang's father seized power in 1979, is currently Africa's longest ruling leader. Since then, he has managed to accumulate a fortune of at least $600 million. Meanwhile, one in three of his impoverished subjects dies before the age of 40. His son is infinitely greedier. You know, I got to do this. I want to get your calls. I want to finish this story and tell you why this man says conservatives are happier than liberals when we come back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Get swimsuit ready and reveal your true shape. Discover Cellulize. Hi, I'm Dr. Michael Gray. A new technique that breaks up cellulite and fat directly underneath the top layers of the skin. Once cellulite fibers are destroyed, the skin looks smoother. Cellulite is no longer a reason to stay out of the swimsuit this summer. Summer 2012, reveal your true self, cellulite free. It's possible. It's Cellulize.
Call 248-538-3333 or anewyou.com.
Call me today, and I'll see you tomorrow. Nationwide, most women prefer scarless breast augmentation. I am Dr. Michael Gray, and I've been performing this scarless procedure for over 20 years now. It is still the number one choice among women choosing breast augmentation. Visit anewyou.com to see before and after photos of my scarless procedure. Schedule your complimentary consultation to learn why scarless breast augmentation could be right for you.
Call 248-538-3333.
I am Dr. Michael Gray. Call me today, and I will see you tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to 101 WRIF on the World Wide Web at WRIF.com.
You were
Everything that rocks. Worldwide, you're listening to WRIF.com.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Keep listening for your chance to jet off to catch Aerosmith live in Denver. Learn more online at WRIF.com.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan.
Hi, thank you very much, and welcome back, Jolene Jordan. Under the weather, laryngitis. You want to go to our Facebook page at facebook.com/nightcall. You'll see what she has to say about it. We'll have a podcast available of this show in about 12 hours, thanks to Athena, who is also taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF. I was just looking at the email at that address, and hey, I got an invitation. Christoph Urbanski has been named principal guest conductor of the Tokyo Symphony Orchestra, and I've been invited to a reception for him. Tuesday, August 7th. I think I'm going to make it. Let me see. Where is it? A press conference with Mr. Urbanski will be held at the Embassy of the Republic of Poland in Tokyo. You know, I actually got an invitation. I'm not going, obviously. I got an invitation to talk during at this event in London, where a friend of mine is actually giving a keynote talk and an offer of an apartment during the Olympics. So I said, man, this is, how cool is this? $1,200 for a flight? I don't think I'm making that. All right, I want to talk about why conservatives are happier than liberals, according to this conservative, but let me finish up. Remember, we're talking about health care. They're talking about so many people in this country, tens of millions of people without it. Some of these conservatives are worried. Actually, I'm a little worried, too. What's going to happen when there's this huge influx of people into the medical system? Are we, quote, going to be able to afford it? I mean, here's a country, ours, that already has a pretty big national deficit and debt. And I was thinking, so what in the world does this article, Keep the Dictators Out of Malibu, have to do with it? We're talking about Teodorin Obiang, who is the son of the dictator of Equatorial Guinea. And the father has been in there since 1979. So that's, what is it, 40? I can't even do the math. Long time. And longest ruling leader. He has since then managed to accumulate a fortune of at least $600 million. Meanwhile, one in three of his impoverished subjects dies before the age of 40. His son is infinitely greedier. In 1993, President Obiang awarded Teodorin, then 24 years old, logging concessions on nearly 90,000 acres of rainforest. The following year, he was named Minister of Forestry. He has a salary of $7,000 a month. Teodorin spent more than $300 million, according to the Justice Department, acquiring assets and property on four continents between 2000 and 2011. Pardon me. In America, his main purchases were a $30 million Malibu estate and a $38 million private jet, not to mention more than $1 million worth of Michael Jackson memorabilia. He also bought an $80 million home in Paris, a $15 million property in Sao Paulo, nearly $6 million worth of wine and paintings by Degas, Renoir, and Gauguin. Companies that paid him off could cut down trees wherever they liked, including in reserves allegedly protected under the country's laws. Companies that refused to pay bribes got kicked out and had their property and equipment stolen. Despite this sordid record, legal loopholes and accommodating American attorneys and accountants have allowed Mr. Obiang to launder huge sums into the United States. So, I mean, this seems like just another, what, sordid tale of greed and corruption. You know, and like, yeah, I would expect, you know, these third world countries. But what the hell's the difference? I mean, it's clear that a nation has a certain amount of wealth. And it's consumed which has to do with how it's distributed. So you can have, and think about it. I mean, this guy is a piker compared to the American billionaires. And so when we have cities impoverished, when we have even cities, usually we think of big cities that are impoverished, like Detroit, where, I mean, you know, kids are, what is it? One in, I forgot what it is here. Well, all these headlines. Nearly one-third of middle class suffers downward mobility. One in two people are poor or low income. Whoa, what did you say? In the United States of America, one in two people are poor or low income. Well, all the money's here. So what the hell is the difference between the United States and Equatorial Guyana? Huh? You tell me. 313-298-WRIF. 67% of Detroit kids live in poverty. Right? 313-298-WRIF. And let's go to Dylan in Waterford, and then I want to talk about why conservatives are happier than liberals, according to a conservative. Hi, Dylan. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, I want to start off, but this is my first time being on air. This feels pretty cool.
Well, welcome. Glad to have you. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, no problem. And, like, I don't know. I've been living on my own since I was 16, so I fit into that one of two people that are poor.
Yeah, yeah. And don't have health insurance, I assume.
Yeah, I do.
Oh, you do have audio from your parents?
Yeah, I'm under my dad still, but...
Okay. And if I may ask, because this is important in this conversation about healthcare, how old are you?
I'm only 18.
Yeah, so now you can stay for another 8 years under the new plan.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not really for the new plan yet. I mean, it hasn't really convinced me. I do think the new health plan is a scam, but...
Why do you think it's a scam? I mean, it's going to give you protection in case you can't do it yourself.
It's going to give me protection, but yeah. It's not going to give, I don't know. I don't really like it.
Okay.
I don't really like the idea of it, I guess. But,
Well, wait a minute. But what about the idea of a, like they have like in every other country, a universal, you know, single-payer plan that the government, you just walk in. You know, you don't have to have any plans. You don't have any premiums or anything like that. You just walk in. You say, hey, I got a boo-boo. You know, I'm sick or, I fell off fell off a bar stool or fell off a skateboard or something like that. Fix it up. And they go, okay, sure, here, bye.
Well, they've been doing that for years. I mean, I don't think really America is ready for it with the way it's going. I think, personally, I don't think it's going towards a dictatorship. I think it's going more towards either socialist or communist, if you will.
You said it's not going to a dictatorship. I mean, the thing that was wrong in my mind with communism was that it was administered as a police state. You know, that if you stepped out of line, the man come and take you away, according to like a song a long time
ago. Well, that's what's happening now. I mean, in Detroit even, I can't skateboard without a cop coming up to me and telling me that it's illegal, even in Pontiac, like 20 minutes away from me. I can't skateboard without getting arrested. I think...
Where are you skating? That may be the problem.
Well, even in downtown Pontiac, I can't skateboard in downtown Pontiac because it's illegal. I can't skateboard in downtown Detroit because it's illegal.
Wow.
Like, it's a big problem. And
yeah. Well, maybe even, I don't know, bigger than healthcare. All right, Dylan, thanks for calling the first time. Make it another time in the weeks to come. I appreciate you calling 313-298-WRIF. Seth and Warren, I'll get right to you in a minute, but here is what I've been leading up to for the longest time. Why conservatives are happier than liberals, according to Arthur C. Brooks, who is the president of the American Enterprise Institute. Which is a far right wing think tank, even though I think that's an oxymoron, internal contradiction, if you will. So who is happier about life, liberals or conservatives? The answer might seem straightforward. After all, says Arthur C. Brooks, there is entire academic literature in the social sciences dedicated to showing conservatives as naturally authoritarian, that's true, dogmatic, that's true, intolerant of ambiguity, true, fearful of threat and loss, true, low in self-esteem and uncomfortable with complex mode of thinking. So obviously liberals must be happier, says Arthur C. Brooks. Wrong. Scholars on both the left and right have studied this question extensively and have reached a consensus that it is conservatives who possess the happiness edge. Wow. I'm pretty happy. Maybe I should become a conservative. I'll be happier. Many data sets show this. The Pew Research Center in 2006 reported that conservative Republicans were 68% more likely than liberal Democrats to say they were very happy about their lives. Anybody have any thoughts about that? Like, what was happening in 2006 and what, and the whole problem? You know what? There's a whole thing is that the two things that people consistently are, don't respond truthfully about are sex and religion. So if you ask people, how many times a week do you have sex? You know, 45. Well, my wife and I, you know, three times a day. Yeah. Well, not on Sunday, because then we go to church three times a day on Sunday. Well, I mean, it all turns out to not be true. And one of the ways they get at that, they'll ask people, they'll say, think about all your male friends. How many times a week do you think, say you're talking about somebody in their mid-40s, and if you're thinking of, you know, middle age is starting at 40, probably is up, you know, these days. But that, traditionally, that's what it is. How many times a week do you think your male friends have sex with their wives? The guy will say, hey, I don't know, probably once a month, you know, what they say, or maybe never, or once a week at best. And true with all of them, yeah, none of them, they hardly ever have sex. They're always complaining, you know, to me that that they never have sex with their wives. How about you? Oh, we do it every night, you know. So, you know, you see where that's going. Religion, oh, yeah, we're just filled with faith. You know, we're practicing Christians. And you know, how frequently do you go to a church? Oh, every single Sunday. You know, sometimes Wednesdays, too, you know, for Bible school and all. And I've made this point before. I mean, people report church attendance, so America, I thought it was a very religious country. Actually, it's more that the country is dominated culturally by devout Christians who disproportionately affect public perception and public policy. But here's what I mean. A couple of times that sociologists have gone to these small towns when this was all measurable, and they'd ask everybody, how frequently do you go to church? Oh, we go every Sunday. And everybody's saying, we go every Sunday. You know, every single Sunday, sure. And so then they counted up how many people that said they went to church every Sunday and how many churches there were and how much seating there was available. And yeah, you guessed it. They would have had to have, they didn't have the seating capacity for everybody that said they went to church. So when you say to somebody, you know, are you very happy about your life? I wouldn't even know what to say, to tell you the truth. I mean, my life has been pretty rewarding. A lot of it is luck. A lot of it is, you know, where I came from, middle class, white, you know, all that stuff. You know, the male, that all gives you, you know, a heads up on it, to be sure. Not everybody that has those attributes, you know, will say they're very happy. But in 2006, we're in the middle of the Bush administration, and someone said to me, are you very happy? I guess I would say, what the hell do you mean? You know? I mean, this country is fighting this war based on lies. You know, people are coming home in body bags. We've got this president that can't spend one word, can't put one word after the next. That's interesting. That was a little Freudian slip, huh? I couldn't at that moment. At least I wouldn't say 2007. You know, am I very happy? Yeah, I still got a paycheck, but that Reaganomics, led by this nitwit in the White House that stole the 2000 and 2004 election, has just ruined the economy completely. Am I very happy? Oh, I'm just delighted. So, one of the things, these people have their head in the sand, these conservatives. Actually, they have it, you know, where the sun don't shine. And also, you just don't say that to a stranger. I mean, it's the kind of thing that you'd have to do great in-depth conversations about. But anyways, the guy goes on. He says, many conservatives favor an explanation focusing on lifestyle differences such as marriage and faith. They note that most conservatives are married. Most liberals are not. I mean, that's what he says. He says 53% of Republicans are married conservatives and 33% of liberals are not. This maybe has to do with age. Yeah. Marriage and happiness go together, he says. If two people are demographically the same, but one is married and the other is not, the married person will be 18% more likely to say, doesn't emphasize it in the article, he or she is more happy than the unmarried person. You know, I don't know. They're also, they say, because people are religious, they're more happy. Isn't this a load of crap? Or am I right? I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say. If someone said to me, are conservatives more happier than liberals? I mean, I don't know. I would say, what the hell's the difference? Your thoughts on that or anything else that we've been talking about? 313-298-WRIF. Here's Seth and Warren. Seth, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Peter, how you doing tonight? I just wanted to say, first and foremost, I really respect your show. I've been listening to you since I was, back in high school and throughout the years, and stay up late on Sunday night to listen to it. So don't always agree with you, but I think you make valid points that open some people's eyes to maybe a different avenue of belief and when it comes to certain topics. So I do appreciate that. But what I was calling about was...
Well, thank you, though. Yeah.
I jumped in the truck and I heard the tail end of what you were talking about insurance and whatnot and the poor and the lower middle class. And I myself, 5 years ago, all of a sudden accumulated epilepsy. I've had these epileptic seizures and, they just happen sometimes and I fall down and I end up in the hospital, I always had insurance, so when it first started, it wasn't a big deal. And then I lost my job and did some things out of my own freelancing. I don't carry the health coverage that, I had before. And, I've had three major episodes since I have been uninsured, and I'm $70,000 in debt.
Oh.
And there's no way for me to climb out of this hole. There's no way for me to get help, even when I reached out to, DPS and things like that, well, I made too much money prior to not having insurance to be selected as part of, their help program, if you will. And, there's something that needs to be done. And it needs to be looked at in a manner of, our citizens need to be taken care of, because it's not affecting, the rich upper class as much as it is the lower class. Because if you are struggling or barely above that line, and then you do have a catastrophic injury, that puts you into a point that you're not going to be able to get out of.
Well, Seth, do you still have insurance? Have they cut you off?
No, I don't have insurance. No, I've been trying to get health insurance, but the cheapest thing I could find, is about $180 a month.
Well, and I'll tell you, if it's $180 a month, it's not going to do much for you unless you have, some major health catastrophe. I mean, I know people that are paying like $1,000 and $1,500 a month in order for their, just for, them and their wife, just in order to, to make sure that they're secure. Who the hell can afford that?
Right. That's my younger brother. He works, and his wife doesn't, and he has two children, so he has to have the insurance for them. And then he says I work for my insurance at this point. They take all this money out of my check to insure my family and make sure that their health is in, my best interest. And he has young kids, so what is he going to do? He has to have those things done.
Well,
he has to bring them in for wellness checks.
As of 2014, you will you'll be eligible, and depending on your income, what you say you don't have really much of one now, that you'll get these discounts to the point where I wish I had this in front of me. That's why I'm stumbling around the percentages and all of that. But you should be able to have that by 2014. I mean, why it didn't kick in immediately is so far beyond me, but
Definitely, just that's what I wanted to call and make a point was, if there are steps, at least it is in the right direction. But that's, I think in my mind, that's what pushes that that lower class into more and more debt, just because nobody knows when they're going to step off the curb and break their ankle.
Sure.
So and that's hundreds and hundreds of dollars. I mean, my ambulance ride a quarter of a mile. I won't tell you what city it was. It was a quarter of a mile from where I had my incident to where they took me to the hospital, and that was $938.
Oh, my God.
It's just out of control. I understand both sides of the argument when it comes to the hospitals and what they have to charge versus what they lose for, uninsured that they're not going to get back. But at the same time, they're hardworking citizens in this country that, deserve the right to, not become poverty because of an ailment or an injury or something like that. You know, it's just, it's terrible, and it's...
I think it's beyond terrible. I think it's criminal. And I think, I mean, you're getting poor, poorer and poorer and poorer, deeper and deeper in debt. And this country is about wealthy people loaning money to poorer people to drive them deeper in debt for houses, for cars, for all of that. I mean, this country, with student loans, you know, the health insurance, all of it. So they're doing just fine. And in the meantime, you know, people like you are, I don't even know what to say. All right, Seth, I'm sorry to hear all this, but thank you for your
support. I appreciate you, Peter. Have a great night.
All right, thank you very much. Let's see, I want to get this on Brent, and then also Athena. I can't see who's in Westland, and also David in Detroit, who's asking apparently a good question, how is this going to all be paid for? But remember I said, if you were listening through the whole show, that these tax-exempt groups that have been allowed now by this Republican right-wing Supreme Court that says money is speech, and that these billionaires, these right-wing billionaires and these big corporations can give as much money as they want, and they're pushing for limited government, which means they want no regulations on them. Well, here's what's happening. This was on Saturday. A woman in a blue here, Romney donors out in force in the Hamptons. And if you live around here, the Hamptons probably don't mean a lot to you. But in New York, in that area, this is where the swells go, right? A woman in a blue chiffon dress poked her head out of a black Range Rover here on Sunday afternoon and yelled to an aide to Mitt Romney, "Is there a VIP entrance? We are VIP." No such entrance existed. The line of cars waiting to enter a Romney event at a waterfront estate here had reached 30 deep, testament to the Republican candidate's fundraising might on a weekend when he's expected to haul in $3 million in the Hamptons. Mr. Romney arrived in this town of outsized homes and conspicuous consumption for the first of three major fundraisers on Sunday afternoon, his motorcade of Chevrolet Suburbans passing a gleaming line of Bentleys, Porsche, Mercedes-Benz, waiting to deposit guests who paid up to $25,000 ahead to hear him speak. A luncheon fundraiser was held at the sprawling home of Ronald O. Perlman, the billionaire financier and chairman of Revlon. Widely described as the largest estate in East Hampton, it has 40 rooms, 9 fireplaces, and takes up a mile along the Georgica Pond. After that, Mr. Romney, a former Massachusetts governor, was also scheduled to attend fundraisers at the Hamptons home of Clifford Sobel, the former United States ambassador to Brazil, and the billionaire industrialist David M. Couch. I'm sorry, how could I say his name wrong? David H. Koch, a major donor to conservative causes. In fact, the man that invented the teabaggers, right? The event at Mr. Koch's home, the biggest of the day, was expected to attract a sizable crowd of protesters. By the way, this at his house, it was $75,000. In brochures promoting the demonstration, this is the demonstrator, said they opposed the ever-growing and pervasive influence of Koch Industries, the company controlled by Mr. Koch and his brother Charles, a couple of the richest men in the country, which is one of the reasons that there's so many poor people. At Mr. Perlman's house, a handful of guests stuck in the line outside rolled down their tinted windows to chat or simply shouted from their convertibles of their enthusiasm for Mr. Romney and disdain for President Obama. Can you imagine these rich a-holes just yelling all this? Laura R. Schwartz in New Jersey, the woman inside the Range Rover, complained that Mr. Obama had not visited Israel as a president, a slight to the country in her eyes. Oh, well, that's a good reason to give millions of dollars to this guy. I don't think he's good for Israel, she said. What about this country, lady? A few cars back, Ted Conklin, owner of the American Hotel in Sag Harbor, New York, long a favorite of the well-off and well-known in the Hamptons, could barely contain his displeasure with Mr. Obama. Mr. Conklin said from inside a gold-colored Mercedes as his wife, Carol Simmons, added in agreement, "He is a socialist. His idea is to find a problem that doesn't exist and get government to intervene." Yeah, like healthcare. Yeah, tell that to Seth, right, who just called. Miss Simmons paused it to highlight what she said was her husband's generous spirit. "Tell him who's on your yacht this weekend. Tell him." This is over Mr. Conklin's objections. Miss Simmons disclosed that a major executive from Miramax, the movie company, was on the 70-foot yacht because she said there were no rooms left at the hotel. See, these guys are generous. In Southampton, where Mr. Koch lives, the local police spent much of Sunday gearing up for as many as 200 protesters, a rare sight in these precincts. The packed schedule of fundraisers seemed to create some confusion among the guests. As he pulled up outside Mr. Perlman's estate, Ms. Schwartz's companion initially wondered if he was at the home of the Koch brothers. Oh, he said, not yet. Ms. Schwartz explained, we're going to go to every one of them. Now, you might say, look, there's been big fundraisers with $40,000 entry fees put together by George Clooney, who the conservatives are very happy, caught food poisoning in Italy this weekend. But you know what? The people that contribute to the Democratic Party, and again, I'm not real fond of a lot of the policies of President Obama, but the donors, these are millionaires, very few billionaires, millionaires with a heart. They want President Obama to be in there because they want health care, because they want to end wars, not start them. I mean, there's a, I don't even go there. I mean, whatever their motivation, they're like my family are big liberal supporters, and they're always disappointed in the Democratic candidates. And, you know, and they were very enthusiastic about Obama and now are kind of disappointed in him that he didn't do more about this and more about that and didn't follow, you know. But their motivation, their desire for a world where people aren't like Seth that get into $70,000 of debt because he's got epilepsy and because kids leave college with $50,000 and $100,000 in debt and because we got to pay first responders in Scranton, you know, $7.25 an hour and two-thirds of the kids in Detroit live below the poverty line and on and on and on. They want to stop that. The conservatives want to conserve what is. They want to conserve what is. They're okay with it just like it is. In fact, they want to go back, further. They want no regulations on all the rich people. And this is at the top. This is the 1%. But they've got to find some suckers that will back them because, hey, they want to make more money than they already have, and they're rich beyond belief, rich to the point that they force other people to be poor. That's how rich they are. In the richest country in the world, the 1% and the 10% have accumulated so much wealth that it means that half the people in this country are either poor or near poor. And the other thing, and in fact, I was going to bring this up, which no one ever answers. The conservatives have been on the wrong side of every social question and every political dispute and debate in this country since its origins. And I've said, listen, call me at 313-298-WRIF and tell me where the one time in American history, beginning with when the conservatives wanted to stay as a colony of Britain, tell me one point in history where the conservatives were correct. It doesn't exist. They're on the wrong side of every single social question, and today they're on the wrong side of everyone. Well, you know, just because, and again, there's a difference. The 1%, they're doing it all because they're protecting and expanding their wealth at the expense of everybody else, the 99%. But we have the cannon fodder, the people that are making below $50,000 that are saying, well, I like Romney.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Thanks for listening to 101 WRIF on the World Wide Web at WRIF.com. Everything that rocks, worldwide. You're listening to WRIF.com.
news, guys. Hey, it's Susie Cole from The Rip, giving you the heads up that WRIF.com and Pepsi are keeping your finger on the pulse of the music world. I'm talking about my Riff Rock Report online at WRIF.com. Check it out to find out what's happening in the world of rock, including my blog to get the scoop on new music, local bands, shows, and events happening in and around Metro Detroit.
It's Susie Cole's Riff Rock Report.
Powered by Pepsi. Live for now.
Check it out today at WRIF.com. They're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Jolene.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back. Jolene is out for the evening, and she'll be back next week. I thought there'd be more Remedy. She has laryngitis. You go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/nightcall. Join us. Always a lot of interesting stuff there. Regarding how the callers sound, we were getting some complaints last week that they were too low. Jerry writes in the call talk, yes@yahoo.com, callers are sounding much better as long as they speak up, all in all, much better. And remember Dylan, who was saying that he was on his parents' insurance but didn't like the health care plan because it sounded like a scam. And Jerry says, I wonder what he would do if he wasn't being scammed into being on his parents' insurance, and then he wipes out grinding a radical handrail and suddenly develops a new elbow. Yeah, that's a good question. Let's see here. Nick writes in, I want to thank you for starting the show off by talking about the Koch brothers and how they are paying to get what they want passed through the Republican Party. Also talking in brief and in a clear way on their terminology on jobs and medical and limited government. He said, I've been fighting with some friends today about this, and I hope they are listening to the show like I told them to so they can hear the truth. Well, or my opinion. Actually, it's the truth. Lyndon writes in, government in a democracy is representation for the masses. The government is us. We have the ability to control government that serves everybody. Corporations' only purpose is maximizing profits. Sounds like Mitt Romney is a corporation played by a human being. Wow. Yeah, I'd say it's true. Okay, let's go back to our phone, 313-298-WRIF. Here is Brent in Taylor. And by the way, I just should say, set up Brent's call. Brent was going to comment on this contention by conservatives that conservatives are happier than liberals. What do you think, Brent? You're on the air.
I think if you bury your head in the sand long enough, yeah, you're going to be happy. Yeah. You don't know what's going on around you. You're content, you know. You get to a point in life where everything is just, you know, everything's running smoothly, and that's, you want everything to stay the same so you don't have to adjust, because the greater majority of people are afraid of change.
Don't you think too, Brent, that there's a level of anger that belies happiness that often they express? You see their rallies. I mean,
Yeah, people will fight tooth and nail to hold on to what they think is their best situation or the way things work best for them.
Yeah.
You know, that's just human nature, you know. But, I mean, there's people that are going to bury their head in the sand, and then there's a saying that goes, you know, he who is resistant change is destined to perish. You know, do you want to stay in the same situation? I mean, are you happy making what you make? Are you happy providing what you're providing for your family? You know, you're going to get stuck in a tax bracket, or you're going to get stuck, you know, $78,000 in debt because you're epileptic all of a sudden, and you don't know what's going to happen because you're stuck in the way you allowed things to develop around you by not taking action, not voting, not trying to influence policy around you in your local government or in your state or in your national government, and you're just going to try to hold on to what you have, and before you know it, it's just going to be taken right out from underneath you.
Yeah, the rug is being pulled out from under these people as it is from the rest of us, but it's like you say. I mean, you had a nice way. You said head in the sand. Remember, I was saying their heads where the sun don't shine. You have a situation where the majority of white people earning less than $50,000 a year vote for the Republican Party. This is a party that is committed to wiping them out. Yeah, and yet, I mean, like I always say, it'd be like Jews voting for the Nazi Party in Germany. It's that bad. It's actually that bad.
I mean, it's people blindly following propaganda. It's like I was just saying to my dad earlier, and let me just precursor this by saying I'm not racist at all. People are going to go and vote for Mitt Romney because he's not the black guy.
You know what? There won't be a single person voting that will say that. But that I think they won't say that. But that's very deep. That's a very deep motivator for sure. Yeah. But you know what? I'll tell you. A lot of these people that vote like that, they just vote out of resentment. And if the Democratic Party was stronger in advocating what's called in Europe social democracy, a social democratic program, these people would easily overcome their race, their concerns about race or their voting that. So a lot of that, I mean, is trying to, you know, this dishwater approach that the Democrats always carry out. They say, well, let's not offend anybody, you know, wind up not energizing anybody. In fact, it was Barack Obama, in part because of his ethnic origin or half of his ethnic origin, that really motivated people. Because the people that voted for him, you know, thought that they weren't even voting for him because for his policies, particularly.
Yeah, not that they believed in what he was standing for, just because, hey, this guy's promising change, I guess. Let's jump on the bandwagon.
Yeah, but that's not so bad. I mean, it's not the best way to go about things. It should all be about policy. But
I'm not saying conservatives have the right idea. I don't believe that they're happier, or if they are, they're happy for the wrong reasons. You know, change is a good thing, but it all depends on how you go about it. Now, that other kid saying that he thinks that we're being pushed towards a socialist state because we're going for national health care or socialized health care. What's wrong with socialized health care? What's wrong with a 25-year-old guy who makes $30,000 a year supporting two kids and his wife being able to go and get his diabetic test strips?
You think? Yeah.
You know?
I got you. All right, Brent, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF. Let's see. Here we are with David in Detroit. David, hi. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, I've been listening in on the conversation, and it's pretty much similar to what, you know, we all talk about, either at the dinner table, work, or what have you. And really, the question still comes down to how is this going to get paid for? Because bottom line, like it or not, we are still living in a capitalist society where if you look to gain services from another individual, that individual has to be compensated.
Right.
And if they're not being compensated, you're essentially stealing from them. That's the doctors, that's the dentist,
sure.
That's all this stuff supposedly covered under health care.
Well, according to the Act, the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, and according to the analysis of the Congressional Budget Office, that it will be a wash, that savings and also taxes on people over $250,000 will pay for it. But you know what? I'm not real confident about that. So what are you going to say? Well, look, we're already got a debt. We got a deficit. What are we going to do? Well, we're spending $1 trillion a year on running our troops all around the world in wars we never had to fight. I mean, like Ron Paul says, if we would pull, I mean, I agree with him. He says, pull all of our troops out of all these bases all over the world. I just heard of this conservative commentator coming in, talking about the embassy in Iraq. It's costing us $1 billion a year. I mean, we could afford to have the Cadillac of health insurance for everybody if we had a sensible military policy, which we don't.
Funny you mentioned Dr. Paul. I'm actually a Paul supporter, but I don't know. Did you guys know that?
Did I know what? Did you know
that I was a Paul supporter? That's kind of funny that you'd mention his name.
No, I didn't. But, you know, there's a lot that I agree with him on. There's a lot I don't. But whatever, if you followed his foreign policy, we would have all the money in the world to pay the Scranton first responders, to make sure that we had adequate schools. I mean, it's all the money's there. It's all
well,
there.
If you've heard him speak about this, then you also know that as a doctor, he performed services at a time when you had charitable hospitals that, you know, if you couldn't afford to pay, you couldn't afford to pay. Or if you could only afford to pay a little, you paid what you could afford. Why is it that what happened at the point when doctors, when you used to see a doctor and a doctor used to make house calls, that it used to cost you maybe a day's worth of work? Now it costs you about a month's worth of work if you're lucky.
Yeah.
So at what point did that start to happen?
Well, I don't know. I mean, if people are making a lot of money out of it. I mean, that's the, I hate, they usually don't use this cliche, but it's apt here. That's the bottom line. I mean, people, as you said, we live in a capitalist system. It's always about maximizing profits. And sometimes, in fact, I would say often, maximizing profits hurts people. All right, David, I got to get some more calls, so thank you. I'm sorry to cut you short. We're getting towards the end of the show. Here is Paul. Paul's in Sterling Heights. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for taking my call, Peter.
Sure.
I put my money where my mouth is. I donate to a number of liberal candidates, and because of it, I get put on email lists. You know, I'm talking about guys who are really socialist, like Bernie Sanders, and Sherrod Brown, and Liz Warren out of Massachusetts. Okay, so Franken and Sanders and those guys are now sending me emails wanting me to sign up for a petition for a constitutional amendment to overthrow the Citizens United ruling. Okay.
The Supreme Court ruling, which allows corporations to give unlimited amounts of money. Yeah, or whoever. Yeah.
My lawyer is a corporate attorney. You know, these are the guys who tell you who the party of the first part is, who the party of the second part is. It's all about defining what a contract is. And I go and I ask them about what, you know, I mean, really, if you look at it, what that constitutional amendment should say is, who is a person?
Right.
Who is a person? And this is what my attorney brings up. There have already been a couple of measures in the states wanting to say that a person is a zygote. A person is a fetus. That from the time an egg is fertilized in a woman, that is a person. Now, put that in the same context as trying to write a constitutional amendment.
Well, wait, before we go too much farther, I mean, that's these nutty personhood amendments that didn't even do well in Mississippi. I mean, there's a different idea. I mean, there's been a lot of states going back into the 1880s that when they realized the power of money to influence elections, actually passed laws saying that it was illegal to contribute money in order to determine the outcome of elections. And they've, and corporations specifically were forbidden to do that. And with this, the idea, though, that, you know, to loose the power of money upon us again, I mean, not like it wasn't there before, but now just in sums unbelievable, this is what this constitutional amendment proposes. All right, Paul, thank you very much. Now, I'll tell you what, if you can, no matter who you contribute to, you're going to get more solicitations. Like my wife and I think I may have told you this, we never buy presents for anybody unless they really need something. So these people that just got married that, you know, they didn't need it. They have everything they need. You know, they're going off to honeymoon to Europe. What the hell? What am I going to buy them? A badminton set? So we decided since Planned Parenthood has become under, you know, direct attack by the right wing, and it does so many incredible, important services for poorer women, we decided we're going to give $100 to Planned Parenthood. So my wife said, should I just write him a check? I said, absolutely not. I'm going to go to the bank. I'm going to get a money order, and I'm going to make it out for $100 to Planned Parenthood, and I'm going to take it over to their office, like in Ferndale, and I'm going to say, here's $100. You know, use it in the right way. Why? Because if I send in my name and address, and this doesn't matter where you are in the political spectrum, this, you'll get this from everybody, they will spend $70 of that sending me solicitations for more money for the next 20 years. So that's why I don't do it. Well, all of a sudden, we have jillions of callers, so I'm going to go through these pretty quickly. Here is Matthew, who's in Toledo. Matthew, hi. Tell me quick.
Hi. I was just kind of curious. I don't see how the Republicans want to destroy the middle class, but, you know, with that said, I mean, my question to you then is, What has, honestly, the Democrat Party ever done for the middle class?
Well, there wouldn't have been a middle class without the Democratic Party, because you got to remember. Remember I said the conservatives have been on the wrong side of every social question in history. There simply used to be the ruling class, the ruling elite, and the 1%, and then there'd be this small little teeny middle class of administrators and shopkeepers, and then 85-90% of the people in the country were wage slaves, working under the worst conditions, no safety conditions, 10-12 hours a day, no retirement, no Social Security, no minimum wage, no right to organize. And so the New Deal politics, the New Deal policies of the 1930s through the 1950s and 60s were what created a middle class. They said, and the unions are what created the middle class. They said that working people weren't peasants, that they had to have 5 days work and 40 hours. And when they worked over that, they got overtime. Again, the conservatives didn't want any of it. They fought every union. They fought every minimum wage. They didn't want no minimum wage. They fought Social Security, all of that. They've always been on the wrong side of every social question. All right, I'm sorry to do that, but this is what I got to do. Here's Kevin in Detroit. Kevin, you're on the air. What's up?
Right. Let me ask you this. You mean to tell me in Scranton, Pennsylvania, they cut policemen and firemen to $7.25?
Yeah, look it up. I mean, I don't know what I did with it. The article. I had it as, it could be that it was kind of like a political statement. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
They could have been doing it for that. It was a very short article. I think it was in Yahoo News. Might even still be up there. I can't find it for some reason.
Well, let me ask you this question. The whole healthcare debate, I'm going to ask you, do you think race plays a part in that? That's the subtext of it anyway.
Well, I think a lot, sure. Anything that Obama does has that. You know, I mean, remember, he does not insert race to this except, the mildest degrees and issues that don't really matter. You know, some, little inconsequential things. I mean, he is an American president. I mean, talk about somebody who's an American story. Here's a guy that comes out of a broken home, doesn't have any money to speak of and becomes the president of the United States. I mean, it gives credence to that old thing that we always heard. Anybody can become president of the United States. If Mitt Romney becomes the president with all of his offshore holdings, his $100 million Roth IRA, I thought you can only put $6,000 a year into those, he'll become the wealthiest president ever. And in a way, he is perfect for America because we have become this plutocracy, the absolute rule of the rich. We're back to the 1880s, the golden age, but remember, the Gilded Age, and it was the Gilded Age for the 1%. All right, Kevin, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Okay, here is David in Sterling Heights. They need you to do it quickly. I'm almost out of time. Go ahead.
Hey, Peter. Great show. I love you guys forever. Been friends with Screaming Scott forever.
Great.
Real quick, you said before I even touched on the healthcare issue, you mentioned about giving $100 to a charitable organization. I don't remember what you said it was.
Planned Parenthood, yeah.
I worked for a company that did that. They would call you on Sunday through Thursday and, call you at the improper times. Well, if you contribute only 3% has to go to the charitable organization that they're raising the money for. And that's from when I was doing the job, that was the law. So once I found that out, I stopped doing it because I could get $300 off an old lady that couldn't even afford it. And when I thought it was doing people good, like, stuff for police officers, for, bulletproof vests and all that, and stuff for drug programs, and then I found out how much it had. I mean, they wanted to beat my butt, and I told them I was going to go to Fox, too, and I never did.
Well, let me say, yeah, those things, when they call you on the phone and they say they're doing this, you want you to take out an ad in the police, little brochure, that's just total scam. Yeah, I mean, that's why I was saying you give it direct. Unfortunately, I've got to cut you loose and get some final callers, and we can talk. Call back next week. We talk about more about health care. Here is Brooke. Brooke's in Howell. Brooke, hi, you're on the air. That wasn't very interesting. Here is Randy in Troy. Randy, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Peter. I just got a question for you. I'm wondering if there even is a way to regulate how much these big corporations can make, because it seems like they're already so competitive in nature already that they're just competing amongst themselves now, and they've become completely disconnected with the rest of us. So, are they already too big?
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, it's the other word, all those big words from the 20th century, or I'm sorry, from the 19th century, like plutocracy, the rule of the rich, the oligarchies, small number of people control the economy. And, just raise extremely the marginal tax rate for income and also for corporate taxes. Put it back to the last Republican president that didn't make you sneer, which was Dwight Eisenhower. And if we had the tax rate that was present, that he left, he never tried to change it, and the horrible man who was his vice president, Richard Nixon, never tried to change it either. Put all the personal tax rates, the corporate tax rates back to that, and you could still have your $1 trillion war budget. But there'd be enough money that we wouldn't have to be, shortchanging the American people. All right. Thank you very much. Here is Lisa and Taylor. Hi, Lisa. You're on the air.
Hi. I was just going to comment on the healthcare industry and bring in a little about the pharmaceutical industry, that these prices are outrageous if you can't afford insurance or get any kind of help anywhere. I mean, my son's 21, trying to go to college, work. He can't get any help. They are, I know, because the supervisor was sued $2 million for paying doctors to hand out medication for a different symptom. It wasn't supposed to be used for that.
Yeah.
And I just find the whole thing, it's like, they teach you, that's the first thing they teach you in economics, even though I'm not really into politics a lot. But I try to deal.
Well, I'll tell you, Lisa, you have to be now, because our future depends on it. And, to leave the field just to these liars is going to hurt us all. You know, I'm going to have to cut you short on my apologies. And Tim and Brooke, who is back, we're going to have to do it next week. Got a couple of interesting interviews ahead. Stay tuned. Jalene will be back. I'm sure her throat will be in fine shape by then.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this. Detroit's rock station rocks worldwide. You're listening to WRIF.com. Detroit's rock station on the web. Thanks for listening to WRIF.com. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
I give you
everything that rocks.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Well, I'm going to put this right out there that this is a recorded show. I think most of you know these are recorded in advance. This is Friday before the Sunday. It's being aired, and it's hot as hell in Detroit. It's going to go up over 100. I've lost all power at my house. I have no phone, no computer, no nothing. All right, and this is happening all around the country. In fact, there is an article that I just looked at in My Way News. It says, if you want a glimpse of some of the worst of global warming, scientists suggest taking a look at U.S. weather in recent weeks. Horrendous wildfires, oppressive heat waves, devastating droughts, flooding from giant deluges, and a powerful freak windstorm called a derecho. A little add that to the lexicon. And how's this all being reported? I mean, I don't know. Is there still debate about whether there is global warming or not? Here is actually one, doesn't even give what, I don't know, what field he's in, but John Christie at the University of Alabama in Huntsville, well, he's a global warming skeptic. He says, the guilty party, in my view, is Mother Nature. So in other words, just hot as hell. Most of the rest of the scientific world, and I would as well, think it's caused by human activity. But we want to look at both what global warming is all about and also how it's being reported in the news. And joining me is Neil DeMoss. He's a Brooklyn-based journalist. He's written extensively about climate change coverage for FAIR's magazine Extra. You can go to FAIR.org, and includes the article, The Fires This Time. And he said, despite overwhelming evidence that climate change is causing dramatic changes in weather patterns, media coverage has bent over backwards to avoid making the connection between extreme weather events and the warming climate. Let's say hello to Neil DeMoss, and we're reaching him at his office in Brooklyn. Neil, welcome to the broadcast.
Glad to be here.
Well, is there, since you even said that, is there a little bit of a difference? Because here, this piece is called The U.S. Summer is What Global Warming Looks Like. So maybe the media is finally catching up with climatologists?
You know, I'm potentially hopeful, but then again, I thought this, how many years ago was it that, Inconvenient Truth came out? That was like 6 years ago.
Yeah.
It seems like the one thing that does go in cycles, even if the climate doesn't, is attention to the climate. I would love if, you know, this crazy heat wave and the fires and the derecho and all these things were actually, waking people up a bit. There was, you know, this great AP story, a couple days ago that actually did say, they talked to scientists and they said, this is what climate changes looks like. This is what we're expecting to see. I need to see a couple more articles, you know, before I'm convinced. But that's what needs to happen, you know. I mean, clearly, you know, if this is what we're seeing, then, you know, journalists need to be out there reporting on it and saying, okay, how much of this is climate change? And even if you can't say whether this particular storm or this particular heat wave is climate change, is this what we're going to be getting in the future if we don't do something about it?
Well, I know. I was thinking about 1988 when we had, here in Detroit, about 10, 11 days over 100. It hadn't rained in a month. And so the idea, as this one prof, and as I said, doesn't even say what department he's in, at the University of Alabama in Huntsville, it was Mother Nature. In other words, some summers are real hot. Last summer here in Detroit, it was pretty cool. And so how do we sort that out?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's you need to have some appreciation of the long view and the statistics, you know, in the same way that if, Justin Verlander gives up six runs in a game, you don't want to panic, right?
Right.
If he gives up six runs in a game, five games in a row, that might be a trend. And I think that is, you know, what we're looking at here. You have Yeah, the science is really clear, you know. The science is really clear on both ends. First of all, you know, are we seeing something that's a trend? There is a dramatic warming trend, you know. I mean, clearly something is happening to the climate, even if we're not sure exactly you know, where is it going to amount to more rain and less rain and what kind of storms, and are tornadoes caused, more tornadoes going to result or not? You know, you can, you, the science may still be out on the details, but the fact that the climate is changing is obviously true. And I think, you know, again, 99% of scientists not named John Christie will agree with that. And then the other piece is, we absolutely know that we're putting more carbon into the atmosphere, and we absolutely know that more carbon in the atmosphere creates a changing climate. So something is going on, and, you know, it's the job of scientists and the job of journalists covering science and weather to be trying to investigate and explain what the best science knowledge is out there. And that's what I'm, you know, have been reporting on for years, is that instead of even asking those questions, typically it's, oh, look, there's wildfires. Let's talk about, you know, La Nina. Let's talk about whether or not there is more standing trees that haven't been cut down. And let's just steer clear of climate change as a topic entirely, except maybe to have one paragraph buried deep in the article saying, well, of course, it could be climate change, but no one can really pin anything to climate change, so let's move on.
Well, Neil DeMoss, you write for Extra, the publication of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. You go to fair.org, and it's an organization I support, and they really are interested in fairness and accuracy in reporting. And one of their main criticisms of the mainstream media, the corporate media, is that it never gives both sides of the story, and yet it seems somewhat that here that FAIR is complaining that they're giving the climate skeptics a voice.
It's not that they're giving the climate skeptics a voice, it's that they're presenting them as equal. And I think that, again, that AP story that appeared a couple days ago quoted John Christie saying, you know, I blame Mother Nature. And that was fine, and I, you know, don't see a problem with saying that this is what these people are saying. However, it then went on to say, you know, the vast majority of scientists would disagree with him, which is putting it in the context that people need to understand. You know, it reminds me of back in the days, the early days of the Iraq War, when you'd have, like, I don't know, 500,000 people marching on Washington, and then, like, 10 people across the street at a pro-war rally, and, you know, the media would be saying, rallies on both sides in Washington today.
Yeah.
You know, again, it's all about putting things in context and about explaining you know, what the actual evidence is out there, and not just sort of throwing up your hands and saying, oh, well, some people think this and some people think that. So who are we to say? We're only journalists.
You know, it's interesting. One of the headlines was that 4,000 heat records have been broken. And I guess this is a typographical error. Oh, maybe not. It says since January 1st, the United States has set more than 40,000 hot temperature records. And you think that's correct, or do they mean 4,000?
It could be 4,000, but in any case, it's you know, it depends. There's a lot of different places that can set a lot of different records on a lot of different days.
So. Yeah, I have to say, I didn't do any cross-country skiing this year, that was for sure. You know, you needed just light jackets. But one of the things I've always been so puzzled by, how this turned out to be politicized, and that the right wing has been the main skeptics, the climate change deniers. What is up with that? Well, you know, here, let me tell you one thing. Years ago, I mean, it could have been much as 10 years ago, I heard, and I mean, he's so popular, I don't mind saying his name, Rush Limbaugh. I heard him saying, this climate change stuff is a plot to take away your SUV. Now, what is up with that? I mean, where are these guys, these climatologists, they're not politicized, or are they?
No, I'm sure some of them are, but the vast majority are not. And, you know, I certainly don't think the people who have been raising the alarm about this for, you know, really more than 20 years now, were motivated because they were concerned about SUVs. SUVs hadn't been invented then. You know, I think there's a bunch of things going on here. Obviously, you know, the fact that we had, this debate sort of really heating up, no pun intended, during the Bush administration, and the Bush administration was so resistant to any talk of climate change as being a serious problem. So it sort of became a you know, political football, right? Where you had Al Gore on one side and Bush on the other side. You know, and then on top of it, I think it does make a difference that you have the fossil fuel industry, you know, obviously very concerned about, not wanting, to have to take a hit, whether it's in the form of people consuming less or carbon taxes or whatever.
Or them being forced to put on pollution controls like the Koch brothers who finance the Republican Party to the tune of tens of millions of dollars on their facilities, on their energy facilities, if they would have to spend an incredible amount of money. I mean, you would almost think the amount of money that they're spending supporting Romney and Republicans, they could would be the same cost to put on pollution control.
Yeah, well, that's expecting them to have long-term thinking instead of short-term thinking, right?
So, yeah.
I mean, you know, look at it this way. What is it, 50 years ago now that we had Rachel Carson and Silent Spring and the whole DDT, right? Crusade. There's two things about, I mean, that was tremendously successful, but there's two things about that are different from now. One is that it really was no skin off most people's noses to give up DDT, right?
I
mean, you know, yeah, it might have meant some more wormy apples, but it wasn't going to dramatically change people's lives in the way that some sort of carbon controls would. You know, even well-designed carbon controls are going to change the way things work. And the other thing is, of course, you know, the DDT industry was not nearly as powerful as you know, the Koch brothers. So I think all of this is serving to create, you know, this and support this serious, you know, sort of professional climate denier community. And when you have that out there, it's really too easy for journalists then to sort of throw up their hands and say, oh, you know what, this is controversial. You know, I don't want to be seen as taking sides on this, so I'm just not going to touch climate change because that's something that is, you know, just going to rile people up. We'll just talk about the fires. We'll talk about the, you know, the hurricanes or whatever, and we won't mention it. And you know, you may be getting this, but I don't know if you saw the Media Matters for America study recently that earlier this week, I think, that said in the wildfire coverage, only 3% of all stories even mentioned climate change, which is, you know, incredibly startling. I mean, again, you can mention it and say, what's the evidence? And if there isn't great evidence, then you say that. Although, again, Western drought and wildfires is exactly what all the climate models predict, right? So this is exactly what we would be expecting to see. But I think there's just a lot of journalists out there who are just really steering clear. And I think, you know, to some degree, it's up to, you know, listeners and readers and viewers to be calling in and saying, you have to be addressing this. You know, we want to know answers. It's 102 degrees outside. You know, we want to know whether we're going to have to be prepared for this every summer. And what's the scientific evidence?
Neil DeMoss is my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. Neil DeMoss is a Brooklyn-based journalist. He writes for FAIRS magazine Extra. It's FAIR, FAIR.org. And, well, I think that there's great fear on the part of mainstream journalists to be accused by conservatives of being biased. I mean, all you have to say is, you know, that because, like I say, they've made the right wing has made climate change a left wing issue rather than an issue about, in some ways, about our survival or how at least the level of comfort. But I think many people are going to be facing survival because of issues of survival because of climate change.
Mm-hmm.
And you would think that there would be this this desire to err on the side of caution. Like, I don't know. I'm taking it as a matter of faith that people that are studying it, the climatologists, talking about we're experiencing global warming because of human activity. I don't know. If someone said, prove it, I would be hard-pressed to do it. I'd say, well, the studies show that. They say, well, repeat this. I couldn't even do that. So I'm taking it on faith because I have regard for people that have devoted their life to this kind of study, and they don't have a political agenda. They're not trying to take away anybody's SUV. But let's say they could be wrong. Well, if we put all this pollution control on everything that's creating global warming, from cars to these coal-fired plants, the worst thing that would happen would we would have a much cleaner environment. The best thing we could have is we could begin to erode the climate change. You agree?
Yeah, and I think, the downside is low, although obviously there's a cost, but it's one of those costs that it means that we have to spend money on things which now would not be a terrible thing to be doing, right? You know, I mean, the government going out and spending money on reducing pollution.
No. Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but the Koch brothers ought to pay it, and they ought to eat the cost,
okay.
not the consumer, because that's one of the things they don't want to do either. They don't want to get, you know, they don't want to get everybody say, okay, we're going to put on pollution equipment, but we're raising your electric bill $35 a month. You know, they don't want to face that. So they'd rather, you know, say, yeah, no. Okay,
I'm just saying employing a lot of people, whoever's paying for it, employing a lot of people right now to create more less carbon-intensive technology would not be a horrible problem to have, given the fact that we have so many people sitting around idle. But anyway, aside from that, I mean, you know, the evidence at this point, yeah, I can't do the science, but, you know, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, right, which has been spending decades now at this point, said, you know, greater than 90% confidence that, you know, there is human-caused climate change and we're going to have more extreme weather, more heat waves, you know, more severe storms. And that's pretty much as close as you get to certainty in science. And again, the downside, right? You know, you don't, even if we're not certain of this, and even if, you know, there's a, you know, single percentage chance that we might spend a lot of time and effort trying to reduce this problem, which isn't as bad as we thought it was, the downside really is the destruction of the Earth, and I'm not being, you know, hyperbolic here, right? I mean, things will not look 50 years from now like something that we are familiar with, you know? I mean, there will be millions of, not billions of people, you know, starving of drought and refugees from, you know, climate change created famine and sea level rises inundating cities and storms of the kind that we haven't even seen now. You know, even if there's only a 20% chance of that, to be honest with you, I would want to do something to head it off.
And it's like I say, if you err on the side of caution, you would still wind up with an increased environment that, you know, you wouldn't start having these, you wouldn't keep having these epidemics of asthma among our children and cancers that are caused by emissions and all of that. You know, you mentioned these professional, you used the adjective professional, climate deniers. So talk to me a little about that. Who are they? When? Who's funding it?
You know, I think that a lot of them are. I mean, you know, they're not necessarily people who have gone into this to. I think they were climate deniers to start with. You know, they've just found a niche, and it's working for them. You know, there's a lot of meteorologists out there, oddly. Who are in this world. And meteorologists, I think Columbia Journalism Review did a piece on this a couple years ago that was good, talking about the fact that meteorologists are not climate scientists. You know, they have a lot less training than the people who actually are you know, looking at this stuff. But they're the public face, right? You know, they're the weathermen on TV. And they have the soapbox. And it's been very easy for them to sort of get hooked into this network, you know, and fed, you know, stats from Koch Brothers or wherever.
Well, wait, don't just pass right over that. You said Koch Brothers or whatever. I mean, because now we're talking about where the funding is coming from for these institutes that come up with the conclusion that there is not a climate change caused by human activity, correct?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, you can definitely, you know, you can poke holes in anything that's only a 95% confidence factor if you want to and you spend enough time and money on glossy reports. And it's a real problem that the money isn't necessarily equal, even if the science is, if the science is tipped one way, the money is tipped the other way.
You know, there's also a cultural factor here. Like, you know, we had 101 degree temperatures like it is in Detroit today, 50 years ago, 60 years ago, 100 years ago, and people just were hot. Now it's like a major catastrophe. My wife is ensconced in a friend of ours' house who has power, and, you know, she said, you know, we're going to die here, you know, and us and our little dog. So whereas 100 years ago, we were more used to sweating. So, I mean, there is a factor. I don't want to – this is certain in a way minimizes it or trivializes it, talk about we're going to be hot and sweating, because what we've really become accustomed to, and this is happening across the world in hot regions everywhere from Iraq to India, people are expecting to have a comfort zone that's between like 68 and 78, goes below or goes above it, and people are, you know, beside themselves.
Yeah, although I think a lot of the reaction is not just to a 100-degree day. You know, if it's a 100-degree day, you sort of say, wow, crazy weather today, you know. At least next week it's going to be normal. It's when it's 90, 95, 100 for weeks at a time. And that's, you know, what you're starting to see more often. And, you know, I think that what is what legitimately starts getting people worried. And that's, you know, it's sort of almost like, you know, grassroots science. You know, people's knee-jerk reaction is correct, that's exactly when you start to get worried, is when you get, you know, the buildup of data points, right? When it's not just 100-degree day, but it's a lot in a row. And so, yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, people are probably more expectant of being able to have, you know, have comfort whenever they can. But, of course, you know, probably they're all inside with their air conditioners right now. As long as the power doesn't go out, they're fine.
Sure. I remember I was reading an account of Ernest Hemingway, who had come back from Spain in the late 1930s and was showing a film of the Civil War there. And I was reading the account, and he showed this film at Carnegie Hall. And the description said it was 94 outside and warmer inside, and the place was filled to capacity. And I was thinking, man, you know, no one would go in a theater today if it was 80, right? but we're not talking about individual levels of comfort, but rather some of the larger patterns that you talked about, that, you know, crop destruction, you know, inundation of low-lying land masses and all that. And I think, you know, this is, we were, or at least I was talking about the 1950s, there were all these catastrophe films there that, you know, Earth, and, you know, there's been some since, either too hot, too cold, whatever. But people probably feel powerless. I know my wife said to me, boy, if this is going to be the pattern, what are we going to do? How are we going to prepare for this? And I thought, I don't know. And so how much of this is possible to confront in your estimation?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a lot of people's reaction. And the problem is it's almost the wrong question. You know, how are we going to prepare for an unlivable climate is an answer you can't answer. And, you know, really what we need to be doing is starting yesterday to prevent it from getting that bad. You know, I mean, it's clearly not going to get better anytime soon, right? And we clearly are going to continue to have, you know, even if we take dramatic action right now, we're clearly going to continue to have extreme weather like we have now. But try to imagine how much worse it could get, you know? Imagine 20 years from now sitting and thinking, wow, you know, back in 2012, you know, when we first started having those derechos sweep through, you know, man, we thought that first one was bad.
Yeah.
And that really is the connection that I wish that more people were making, and that more you know, media reporters were making, is not just, is this a sign of this inevitable future, but is there something that we can and should be doing about this? Because that's the only way that we're going to, you know, again, prevent all sorts of horrors. You know, if let's put it another way, if there were a chance of a giant meteor striking the Earth tomorrow, Steve Carell movies aside, people would not be saying, what do we do to prepare for, you know, life after a meteor hits the Earth? People would be saying, okay, what can we do about it?
Sure.
Right?
How can we divert it?
What can we possibly do about it? And I think that's what we need to be saying right now.
Well, and boy, the time is flying. We got about a minute left. So, but ultimately, it's a political question. How? Because, you know, maybe you or I don't fill our gas tank on Ozone Action Day, which is a whole other scam, but I don't want to get into that. But
but
what we're talking about is a large social and political question. How industry functions, what our cars are doing, you know, and all of that. And an individual facing that can really, in a way, only commit sort of ethically based gestures. We're talking about mass impact on the way we live now, and that's a political question.
Yeah, and you know, it's very clear that at this point, nobody. I mean, you know, Obama was as good on this as we were going to get in terms of someone who took the science seriously, and it's clear that he has not, you know, done an awful lot on climate change. It hasn't made it a priority because he's not getting pressed to, you know. People are up in arms about the economy, so that's what he's focusing on legitimately. But political leaders are not going to make this a priority unless they get massive, massive pressure from the public, which means both, you know, for starters, people calling and insisting that this stuff gets reported so it becomes a national concern. And one of the things I think FAIR does great is encourages people, you see something on the news, you see something in the newspaper that's wrong, don't just send off an email or gripe about it on Twitter. Pick up the phone and call the newsroom and say, hey, how come you didn't mention climate change?
I think, as you're saying, one has to be involved, and that's key. And my guest, Neil DeMoss, just mentioned FAIR, and what he's referring to, if you're just joining us, is Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. It's FAIR.org. Neil DeMoss is a writer for FAIR's magazine Extra. I would highly recommend both checking the website, subscribing, supporting their work. Neil DeMoss, thanks for being on the Peter Werbe Show.
My pleasure.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
This is 101 WRIF. Thanks for rocking with us online at WRIF.com. Rockin' Detroit at 101.1 FM and the rest of the planet online at WRIF.com.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. If one thing I think is securely lodged in most Americans' minds is the American Revolutionary War period, the Founding Fathers and all of that, and the idea that this somehow was a period of great national unity among the colonists who fought against the British and made our country independent and set up a free government. It's that we didn't have the kind of turmoil, the ideological contest, the culture wars of today. Well, oh, I hate to break that bubble, folks, but there was a lot of contention. We hear people saying that this is and was a Christian nation and our founding fathers were Christians. Well, to burst that bubble, I'm bringing to our microphones Professor Kerry Walters. He's the William Bittinger Chair of Philosophy at Gettysburg College in Pennsylvania. He's the author or editor of 19 books and more than 100 articles, and he has a brand new book out from Prometheus Books called Revolutionary Deists. That's D-E-I-S-T-S. Early America's Rational Infidels, and I think you'll recognize a lot of the names that we're going to talk about. But let's welcome Kerry Walters to the Peter Werby Show. Thanks for being with us.
Good to be here, Peter. Thank you.
Yeah, now I think we ought to begin just by some definitions and what are deists?
Well, a deist then and now, as a matter of fact, is an individual who believes in God, but believes in a pretty abstract notion of God. So far as a deist is concerned, God is a creator who sets the universe in motion and then kind of stands back and lets the universe operate on its own. A deist in the 18th century, our founding father deists generally rejected any kind of religion that relied upon belief in revelation or miracles or Holy Scripture that one had to take literally. They thought that the best Bible was the book of nature. If you want to know about God, then use your reason and the scientific instruments that your reason has enabled you to make and investigate the heavens.
What do you make of the contention that this is a Christian nation set up by Christian founding fathers? In fact, there's debate about this. I think there are some people that would say, Kerry Walters, you're wrong. These men were devout Christians.
Well, I think that it certainly is the case that there were Christian founding fathers. John Adams, for instance, seems to have been one of them, although, like most believers, he seems to have run through hot and cold periods. But the other side of the coin is that a lot of the founding fathers, or at least a lot of the patriots that we associate with the founding of the nation, might have paid lip service to Christianity because it was just the safe thing to do back in the 18th century. But if you read their writings, their personal diaries, their letters to one another, it's pretty clear that at best they're indifferent to Christianity. At worst, they're absolutely hostile to it.
Did they believe, a deist would then not believe in the divinity of Jesus?
No. And the verdict was out, depending upon what deist you read. Some deists thought that Jesus was a really good moral teacher, but others thought that the ethical teachings of Jesus were disgraceful.
Hmm. Well, in your book, Revolutionary Deists, Early America's Rational Infidels, you highlight a number of the founding fathers and colonial patriots. And probably the most famous is Thomas Jefferson, who was a critic of Christian supernaturalism. But as you say, he admired Christian ethics. And wasn't there even a Jefferson Bible?
There sure was. What Jefferson did, it's an amazing piece of work. Jefferson, of course, knew several languages, including Hebrew and Greek, and he had several Bibles in different languages in his home at Monticello. And he decided one day that he admired the teachings of Jesus, but deplored what he took to be the superstition that larded the New Testament. So he got himself a pair of scissors, and he got himself several editions in different languages of the New Testament, and he began snipping. And the Jefferson Bible, the so-called Jefferson Bible, is the result of all of that editing. He basically edits out accounts of miracles, accounts of healings, until you have left over what Jefferson considered to be the quintessential Jesus, Jesus the philosopher, Jesus, if you will, the deist.
Well, that's blasphemous, though, to Christians, right?
Oh, yeah, it sure is. And Jefferson was well aware that it would rankle a lot of people. And it's no accident that we didn't know anything about the Jefferson Bible until years after Jefferson's death.
Oh, that's interesting. So that wasn't available during his lifetime. I was going to say, how did people react to it? But so did he purposely keep it hidden?
He did. Jefferson is probably one of the most secretive men of this period. Again, a lot of the deists, not all of them, but a lot of the deists wanted to hold their religious cards close to their chest because they were afraid of the social implications of revealing them. But Jefferson in particular never really liked to talk about his religious views, even to his loved ones, much less in public. About the only person he ever opened up to about religious views was John Adams in that really famous correspondence that the two grand old men had in the last 20 years of their lives.
Well, doesn't that, though, contradict a little what you're saying in Revolutionary Deists, that here were these men that were the foundation of our country, yet there was religiosity was strong enough in that era that they had to keep it somewhat suppressed, although not all of them, certainly.
That's true, not all of them. And the tension between Christianity and deism in that period tended to oscillate. Sometimes the deists would feel particularly under a state of siege and would keep quiet, and at other times they would come out hollering the new religion of reason, as they called it. And as the 18th century continued, especially after the French Revolution in 1789, the deists really became militant, and there were newspapers, and there were temples of reason which kind of substituted for Christian churches, and there were public rallies, and there were private and public clubs formed all up and down the eastern seaboard. So as the century progressed, deism really did find its voice. Jefferson was one of those deists, however, who remained reticent to the end.
Mm-hmm. Well, in Revolutionary Deists, Early America's Rational Infidels, you highlight six what you call rational infidels, including Thomas Paine, who he, among all of them, certainly was the most militant in his challenge of divine knowledge or intervention, correct?
He sure was. And you know, he paid a high price for that, too. Theodore Roosevelt, the future president, for instance, called Paine on several occasions a, quote, dirty little atheist, unquote. And Paine has really been reviled from his day right down to the present day. Whenever an individual who isn't sympathetic at all to rational religion wants to trot out an enemy of religion, it's Tom Paine, generally.
But he's well thought of, isn't he? Is he the I'm forgetting. Is he the one that said, give me liberty or give me death? No, that was Patrick Henry.
That was Patrick Henry. Now, but Tom Paine is well thought of, at least as a patriot. There's two Thomas Paines, so far as some people are concerned. There's the Thomas Paine who wrote Common Sense and who was really the best propagandist for the American cause during the War of Independence. It was fine as long as Thomas Paine stuck to that kind of rhetoric. And then there's the Thomas Paine, the deist, who writes The Age of Reason, this wonderful classic that he literally wrote in the shadow of the guillotine. It wasn't clear that he would live through the month as he was writing the book.
This was in France?
Was in France.
Yeah.
Thomas Paine was given because he had gained such a reputation for himself during the American War of Independence. French government, after their own revolution, gave him honorary citizenship. So he relocated to France. He actually became a member of the French Assembly, the French Parliament, as it were, and governed the country, helped govern the country for a few months before he fell out of favor with Robespierre. It's during that time that he was writing The Age of Reason and was thrown into prison right as he finished the book.
And he's got some famous lines. I don't know why I can't bring them up to my brain now. Doesn't Paine have some quotable quotes?
He really does. I think perhaps the most often quoted passage from Paine is right at the very beginning of his Age of Reason when he insists, my own mind is my church.
Huh.
I respect, he says, the religion of the Christians, of the Muslims, of the Jews, of the Hindus, but no institution can tell me what to think. And no institution really can tell any rational person what to think.
Now, where does this all come from, the Age of Reason? I mean, we had, of course, you know, the Reformation in Europe and all the wars between Protestants and Catholics and a whole bunch of religious reasons for what was written into our Constitution about the government not establishing any religion and all that. But what's a larger philosophical context for all of that? Suddenly, when we think of ages ago, you know, centuries ago, that that everyone being religious and steeped in it, and suddenly you have these men that are secularists. What went on then?
Well, I think, Peter, you've really put your finger on an important origin of the movement, and that was the horrible hundreds of years of religious war that ransacked Europe. men and women of reason in the 16th and 17th centuries began to look at all of the bloodshed that was being spilled because of religious dissonance, and they asked themselves whether or not surely there was a more sane kind of religion that could be substituted for the Christianity of the day, one that wouldn't be as intolerant as the Christianity of the day happened to be. So first in France, and then especially in England, in the 17th century and early 18th century, groups of people began to reread the Bible, trying to see if it could be interpreted not as a book of revelation, but as a book of moral maxims and ethical wisdom. They were influenced by the rise of science, the worldview that insisted that the universe isn't mysterious, the universe isn't dark, that it's illuminated, and it's illuminated by natural law, and those natural laws can be understood through human reason. All this matrix, I think, coalesced. It was a perfect storm, as it were. It coalesced into a new way of thinking about religion that tried to get away from the excesses that at least they saw and tried to move toward what they saw as a promising coalition, a promising marriage, if you will, of science and religion.
And how much did it affect the founding fathers in terms of the document that they, the documents, particularly the Declaration of Independence? And,
no.
And this was such a monumental change that people went from being subjects to citizens that had inherent rights. That was a unknown before, maybe a little in the Magna Carta, but certainly it to have a foundation document for a nation was incredibly unique.
It really was, and it was a new dawning, wasn't it? I mean, it seems to me that one of the most obvious influences that the new religion of reason or deism began to exude was in the notion of human perfectibility. You know, the Christianity prior to the rise of the deist tended to be a kind of dour, bleak enterprise in which human beings were thought to be incorrigibly depraved. That was a favorite expression, incorrigibly depraved, meaning that we were so tainted by original sin that neither our reason nor our moral faculties could work on their own, and we depended exclusively upon divine grace. Well, the deist denied that. The deist insisted that human beings could, with their reason and with their conscience, realize truths about the world and realize truths about ethical behavior. And if you read the Declaration of Independence, you see those assumptions, those convictions, in fact, writ large. We have a right to life, liberty, and happiness. Depraved creatures don't have those sorts of rights, and depraved creatures aren't capable of exercising those rights, even if they had them. It's a whole new way of looking at what it means to be human.
My guest on the Peter Werbe Show is Professor Kerry Walters. He is the William Bittinger Chair of Philosophy at Gettysburg College in Pennsylvania, and he's written for Prometheus Books. You can go to prometheusbooks.com, or you can go to kerrywalters.net. There'll be a link on my website as well, peterwerbe.com. The book is Revolutionary Deists, Early America's Rational Infidels, and we're going to get to a couple of these guys before this is over. Six rational infidels who were either founding fathers or colonial patriots. Now, I just ask you this, and I picked up on something you said, that the universe was not mysterious, according to the deist. I guess I would say personally, I think that the universe is so mysterious that it's not understandable, and I actually don't spend much time trying to figure it out. I want to see how I can get rid of my cold. I mean, as a philosopher or as one chronicling philosophy, the whole idea of the origins of the universe, the purpose of life, Bertrand Russell said, when someone asked me, what's the purpose of life, I asked them, what do you mean by the purpose of life? And that usually stops them. I mean, we're here, right?
You bet, yeah.
Well, any comment on that?
Well, yeah, no. I mean, I think that's a perfectly respectable position that you're suggesting. And I think it underscores a possible weakness with the whole deistic worldview, and that is these guys tended to be really optimistic. You know, they were living in the age of enlightenment, where new governments were taking shape, where new ideas were gaining people's imaginations, and they assumed that all we needed was patience and the right mechanical tools and a good dose of mathematics. And in point of fact, we could figure out everything that there was to know. They really didn't have any appreciation, kind of the post-20th century appreciation, if you will, that there are dark and mysterious places in the universe, and then in point of fact, they may not be impenetrable at all.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I'm hesitant even to relay this, but I'll give it a try. I mean, I've heard this said several times. This takes place in a Zen monastery where there's knocking on the door, and the elder monks go to the gate, and there is this disheveled young monk that says, "Masters, masters, I have not slept in 3 days. I must know the meaning of life." And one of them, the elder monks, hits the young man in the head with his stave and says, "There, that'll give you something serious to think about."
I love it.
Or the other, the old thing about what's the meaning of life? Chop wood, carry water.
Yep.
Right.
Uh-huh.
But I suppose that's just another philosophy that, or the stories we tell ourselves of how do we get through what I consider to be this total mystery.
We do tell stories, don't we? And I imagine we tell stories in order to, at least in part, keep ourselves from realizing that there aren't any definitive answers to those sorts of questions. The deists would have answered the question, what's the purpose of life, in a pretty simple way. They would have said the purpose of life is to improve yourself and to improve the society in which you live. They didn't go much beyond that.
All right, Kerry Walters, let's get to some of these men that you write about. Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, Ethan Allen, Thomas Paine, Elihu Palmer, and Philip Fresnel. Am I saying his name right?
Absolutely.
I'm not familiar with him, but the most familiar probably is, maybe even more so than Jefferson, is Benjamin Franklin. But you say he was an ambivalent deist.
He was indeed. Franklin, of course, was the oldest of all of the American deists. He was born at the beginning of the 18th century, raised in a very strict Calvinist household, raised in Boston, a very strict Calvinist Christian Puritan city. And he was caught between, I think, the passing of one worldview into the next. He was raised in a kind of traditional, old-fashioned Christian ethos, and as he aged with the century, that ethos began to increasingly fall apart and give way to the deistic ethos, the deistic worldview. He has a foot in both worlds, and he never really could quite manage to give up the one completely for the sake of the other.
Well, we talked some about Jefferson and Thomas Paine. I'm not familiar with Elihu Palmer. I've heard his name before, but you say he's the most influential proponent.
He is, and he's actually, of all of the deists, and I'm fond of all of them, but he's my favorite. He was a Presbyterian minister who turned renegade quite early on in his life. He became convinced that what he had been trained to preach in the pulpit was just false, was just wrong-minded, and even worse, he thought was dangerous. And so he dropped the Presbyterian collar, and he put on the collar, if you will, of a deist preacher. He's the guy who, even more than Thomas Paine, spread the deistic gospel throughout the eastern United States. I mean, he was tireless in his deistic crusade. And it's even more remarkable because he was blind. A horrible yellow fever epidemic hit Philadelphia in 1793, where Palmer was living at the time. He killed his wife and killed one of his children. He fell terribly ill with it himself, but he managed to recover. The illness, however, took his sight away, and so for the last 13 years of his life, he was stone blind, but managed to write books and give lectures and preach.
Kerry Walters is my guest. He's the author of Revolutionary Deist, Early American Rational Infidels. And if you're just joining us, I know some people just catch different parts of this deism. The idea pretty much that a God kicked the world and the universe into being and the rest is all up to us. It is rational thought in the improvement of the species. And also, isn't it that the world was sort of like a clock that could be, its parts could be discerned and understood many, many ways. Isn't that kind of the origins of modernism?
I think it is in many ways, yes, that's right. Yeah. Certainly the beginning days of modern science, yeah.
Yeah. One of the questions. So you mentioned earlier that there were these deist clubs and this had great expression. How did the organized Christianity respond to all this?
Oh, it was outraged, as you may well imagine. And ironically enough, my guess is that deism became even more popular than it otherwise would have been from being denounced every Sunday from hundreds of pulpits throughout the country. Christians were convinced not only that the devil was at work in New England, as it were, with the rise of deism, but they also were convinced that French republicanism, which they feared greatly because of the example of the French Revolution, was being insinuated into the American scene by the deists. So they criticized them roundly for religious reasons, and they condemned them soundly for political reasons as well.
Yeah, and in fact, and they feared because the French Revolution of 1789 was very hostile to Christianity, even removed the Gregorian calendar.
Yes.
And started the dates over. And Philip Freneau, who is a poet who I have to say I've never even heard the name before, so I'm anxious to read this section of your book. What was his influence?
Freneau isn't known well at all. During his time, he was a pretty influential lobbyist, if you will, for what was then called the Republican Party, the party of Jefferson, the radical party that was suspected by the Christian establishment. And Freneau was a poet in his spare time, if you will, and wrote dozens of poems that, in an interesting way, try to, in verse, describe the basic religious and scientific assumptions of deism. My guess is that his poetry, which was quite popular during his time, probably did just as much as anything that Paine, for instance, wrote to spread the word of deism.
Now, is there an importance to locating the philosophies of the men who founded this country? I said at the beginning, conservatives often say this was a Christian nation and it was set up by devout Christians, or the fact that deism, that does not believe in divinity at all in our lives, is this an important distinction?
I think it is an important distinction. If for no other reason, then how one falls on the question of whether or not the nation was founded as a Christian nation will determine, I think, in large part, how one falls on the question of religious toleration. The deists during their day were staunch defenders of an open-ended tolerance of all religious perspectives. One of the things that so bothered them about the conventional Christianity of their day was what they perceived as its intolerance for alternative or dissenting worldviews. I think that in this day and age, when rhetoric on the religious Christian right, as well as rhetoric in the radical atheist left, is ratcheting up, a healthy dose of reasoned, moderate tolerance, as defended by the deists, could be very helpful.
Yeah, well, certainly we get a lot of that these days. And it's odd how the question of the Constitution has arisen recently. And usually when I say to people, what's the First Amendment all about? They say, oh, freedom of speech, freedom of press, the right to assemble. I said, you forgetting anything? It's interesting that the very first article, or the very first phrase in the Article 1 of the Bill of Rights is that Congress shall make no law establishing religion. If they could have rank ordered it in any way, they could have put free speech first or freedom of assembly, but they put that Congress shall establish shall not be allowed to establish a religion.
I think that is an interesting point that you're making, and I think that you're absolutely right to suggest that there had to be a pretty strong reason for giving that primary place in the Constitution. I suspect that at least two of the reasons were, by the time the Constitution was written, the United States was already an awfully pluralistic society when it came to religion. And I don't just mean pluralistic in the sense that you had lots of different Christian denominations. You also already had a pretty healthy Jewish community living in the United States, primarily in Pennsylvania, as a matter of fact, and New York. And the second reason I think why that particular point about religion in the Constitution is given primacy of place is that the Founding Fathers realized that if there's anything that's going to heat people up, it's going to be debate and talk about religion. I think they wanted to make sure that debate really didn't overwhelm or overshadow other important social and political debates, like I think it's tending to do these days in the United States.
I was going to say so. But here's a good start to get an idea of what our country's all about, and the idea is at least a part of the Founding Fathers and Colonial Patriots. The book is Revolutionary Deists, Early America's Rational Infidels. The author is Kerry Walters. He's the William Bittinger Chair of Philosophy at Gettysburg College in Pennsylvania. It's published by Prometheus Books. If you're in a car and that doesn't just jump out at you, that word, just fool around with the Google and you'll get it. Or better yet, go to either Kerry's website, website. It's kerrywalters.net or Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Kerry Walters, thanks for joining me on the broadcast.
Thank you, Peter. It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
More Riff Rock now.
I don't know what you said, but I'm pretty sure it's something people get neutered for.
The Riff.
If two more should be a war, nobody ever told her it's the wrong way. Don't be afraid of the quickness you get laid, for your family get paid, it's the wrong way. I give her all that I have to give, I'm gonna make it hard to live. Stocky tears running down to her chin, and it ruins up her makeup and never
to jet off to catch Aerosmith live in Denver. Learn more online at WRIF.com.